breeding abilities and the fact that she's pro-life.
And WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's going to be here talking about his new book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, how to turn this economy around and make it work for average, everyday working stiffs like you and me. Dean Baker's an excellent person to talk to on this topic. Also, our good friend Irwin Aronson's going to be here talking about the hurricane and, you know, a little bit about what's going on in the labor law sector, especially as Wilma Liebman is leaving the NLRB and the Republicans are basically doing backflips whenever they hear the letter NL, no matter what it is. Even if it's about baseball, they backflips because they think RB is going to come next. Just kind of nuts. Also in the second hour, Scott Klinger, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, going to be here talking about his piece, Executive Excess, the Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging, which is going to basically go into these companies. They went through 100 companies in the U.S., found that 25 of them, their CEOs made more than they paid in taxes. So the CEOs are, you know, lining their pockets, and they're not kicking into the Treasury. So that'll be an interesting discussion as well. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Look forward to hearing from you on a number of things. Today was my son's first day of kindergarten, and my little buddy is growing up. He's no longer the little guy that I remember. And I go, where'd the time go? But excited about going to his first day of kindergarten, the first day of education, and interesting year, I think it's going to be. And the reason I like public school so much, mass diversity. I mean, in his classroom, I think he just covered every segment of the population, which I think is a very good thing. Now, there's some people who are afraid of that. Some people are afraid of having their children interact with different people. I think it's a good thing. I think it's an enriching experience. I think it's good for his education, good for his ability to deal with cross-sections of people with different circumstances and different backgrounds. And I'm excited for him because it's going to be an opportunity for him to learn and to interact. And that is so important. But I was looking around the room and, you know, you look at some folks and you make generalizations. I mean, you know, one of the couples there was appeared to be a lesbian couple. Very nice. You know, good for them. All and happy about that. Another person looked like to be a, you know, Bible thumper. You know, and I was kind of going, this is going to be fun to watch. So kind of, you know, that kind of stuff going on. So I'm excited about this school year. Going to be quite enjoyable for certain. But again, you know, his first day was just the excitement, the hope, just amazing stuff. Anyway, so with the whole back to school stuff going on, the whole school closed thing, the whole all of that. JCPenney's got itself into a little rub. Evidently, they were selling T-shirts, basically saying that girls are too pretty to do their homework, that they have their brothers do it because I'm just too pretty to do homework. They were selling another one that said, my best subject is boys. And yes, the target demographic for those two shirts started at age 7. And I'm going, you know, I gotta be honest, I think I'm a little uneasy with my 7-year-old or my 9-year-old, to be wearing a shirt that my best subject is boys. I would like her to learn to read much better and, you know, maybe, you know, do a little math before starting to think about, boys and all of that stuff. But school, definitely an interesting time. If you look down in Florida, they've got the, and I've been looking for this to happen across the country, they've passed the pull up your pants law. Florida and Arkansas are the only two states in the country who have the pull-up-your-pants law. In fact, the one Democratic state senator, a guy named Gary Siplin, he's from Orlando, I guess. He's been pushing this for, you know, about 6 years. Today, I guess he was out handing out belts. So they went out there with, you know, a couple hundred leather belts, and they're handing out belts because, you know, now they've criminalized saggy pants. So now you got to pull them up and use your belt, you know, so to mixed reviews. I mean, some folks were, you know, kind of angry about it. The ACLU, again, pretty ticked off about it. The NAACP ticked off about it, because they say it, you know, it violates these kids' freedom of speech. It violates, you know, whatever. And it says basically it's targeting minorities. Now, understand, I remember back when I was dealing with, I was volunteering as a big brother. And the kid that I had seen for about 10 years, he started that baggy drawer stuff, you know, with the, you know, the drawers down around his mid-thighs with his boxer shorts up under his armpits, kind of giving him belt rash under the armpits. And I said, look, I can't be seen in public with you like that. I get it. You want to express yourself. You want to do your thing. You want to be your generation. I'm okay with that. But this is a no underwear car. I don't want to see it. I want you to wear it, but nobody should see it. And, you know, it was one of these things where we went back and forth for a little bit, and I did a little research into it and happened to talk to a prison guard friend of mine who explained where this whole thing came from. And it basically cured the whole problem. All cured. Evidently, and, you know, this is my prison guard friend telling me this, evidently this type of baggy drawer thing came out of prison. And I'm probably going to tick off somebody. Don't really care. Evidently, the guys who were willing to act as the girls in prison were the ones who had the baggy drawers. And they would wear them down with the boxer shorts up as a sign that they were willing. So basically, having these baggy drawers and walking around with your pants falling down all the time was an invitation for, you know, someone else to come over and treat these guys like women. And, you know, bending them over somehow. And that's where it came out of. And as soon as I explained this to the kid, you never saw baggy drawers again. And I think you just have to be honest with people. Is that the message you're sending? And I know someone's going to get upset because there are some that wouldn't mind that because we have them in prison. But at the end of the day, that's what it came down to. And look, people are going to be upset because, well, you know, it's violating my freedom of speech. And to be honest, it kind of does. But at the end of the day, you're in school to learn. That's why I'm a huge fan of dress codes, huge fan of uniforms. But, can't have that. Because I believe all of that stuff's a distraction from education. You know, but then again, I came from a Catholic school background where you had to wear a shirt and tie every day. Or they wouldn't let you in the door. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays itself out. But I'm looking forward to the school year. I don't know if you saw this in Arkansas. The Russellville Middle School near Little Rock, evidently taking a little heat for their top 5 list of worst people ever. And of course, you know, the worst person ever is always going to be Adolf Hitler. I would have thought Satan first, but I guess you have to define what a person is. So Hitler first, Bin Laden second, and then Charles Manson. Well, they're taking heat because, Bush and Cheney are 4 and 5. And I look at this and I go, you know, I don't know that I want my middle school kids knowing who Charles Manson is. I don't think it's important. I think I would rather him learn biology. Just a thought. I don't know that I want them learning so much about the hate and all the stuff that goes into this. I think I would rather have education be just maybe a little bit educational instead of divisive stuff like this. What do you think, Jake? I mean, I'm just not in favor of it.
I agree with you. I mean, what's the point? What's the point in naming the five worst people in the history?
I agree. Bush and Cheney are, some of the top worst people ever, but...
Well, but I believe you can incorporate that when you're teaching history.
If you have to. But here again, what we're doing to education is a shame to me. You look at what's going on in Michigan, and they're taking privatization to that next level. A new piece of legislation being worked on by the head of the Senate Education Committee there in Michigan. He's going to give schools the ability to hire school teachers just like they do temp workers, just like they do J-1 visa students, right, through a temp company. Going to be able to bring them in, expand their privatization scheme so they can hire teachers just like they hire lunch workers or bus drivers. And they claim, they claim it's going to help lower our costs. So, again, before you know it, we're going to be bringing in those J-1 kids to go teach in the Michigan schools. And they get any ideas here in Harrisburg, maybe here in Pennsylvania, too. To me, it's more union-busting tactics. The Republicans are very honest about it. The Republican bill is being sponsored by State Senator Phil Pavlov, and it would give the schools the ability to privatize their instructional services. It's not teaching anymore. It's instructional services. So basically, we can have minimum wage teachers, and that'll be great. And then, we'll make it so that nobody wants to do it, and we'll just have homeless people come in and teach because they got some time. Part of Pavlov's package includes the lifting the cap on state university chartered public academies and creating a, and I love this, a mandatory school choice program. Does that make any sense? A mandatory school choice program. I don't know that mandatory and choice should be in the same sentence like that. Anyway, the privatization piece would require teachers from a private firm to have all the same qualifications, they claim, but just at a much lower price. The guy who's the head of the Michigan Education Association called the idea of instructional services a terrible idea because we'll be turning over the schoolhouses to Wall Street, and I agree. I mean, this is what this is all about. We can't make a DVD player. We can't make an MP3 player. We can't make any of the new technology, no iPads, no iPhones. Can't do that stuff here. So let's go after what we've still got, and that's education, because maybe we can profit from that. And like Pratt says, the guy who's the head of the Michigan Education Association, we're turning our kids over to the lowest bidder. And it is a sad, sad reality. And I congratulate him. He finally figured it out. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, right back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. From Maine to California tomorrow, nurses are converging on 60 congressional offices in 21 states to call for a tax on Wall Street to pay for the economic healing of our nation. Union RNs will sponsor soup kitchens and food pantries as they speak out on the need for jobs, health care, education, and housing. National Nurses United says the message is that Americans are hurting and they need jobs, a secure retirement, and no more austerity cuts. Nurses are asking members of Congress to sign a pledge to support a Wall Street transaction tax that will raise sufficient revenue to make Wall Street pay for the devastation that it's caused on Main Street. National Nurses United says a Wall Street tax on the very speculative financial activities that caused the 2008 financial meltdown could raise hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for the programs desperately needed to reduce the pain and suffering working families are still feeling. As the United Auto Workers Union tries to reach a new contract with the Detroit Three automakers, workers at Ford are voting on a strike authorization in case one is needed. Ford's 41,000 UAW workers are the only Detroit auto workers who can still strike, if necessary. Ford workers want a raise, the restoration of their cost of living allowances, and higher starting wages for the entry-level workers who earn just half of what veteran UAW members make. The Detroit Three auto contracts expire September 14th. UAW President Bob King says concessions and givebacks by the union to help save the U.S. auto industry has cost auto workers between $7,000 and $30,000 each over the life of the contract. The Communications Workers of America aren't waiting until Congress reconvenes to start the battle over funding for the Federal Aviation Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
Republicans have been unwilling to permanently reauthorize funding for FAA programs due to opposition to a new mediation rule they fear would make it easier for airline employees to form unions. The last time the GOP stonewalled funding, it resulted in a shutdown of portions of the FAA, costing the government nearly $400 million. It saw more than 75,000 employees, both FAA employees and construction workers, furloughed without pay. If the Republicans return to Congress with the desire to play games with jobs, it could result in a shutdown as soon as September 16th. The CWA has launched mailers and robocalls, encouraging taxpayers to pressure their representatives to pass a clean FAA reauthorization bill. One of the primary targets of the CWA is House Transportation Committee Chairman John Mica of Florida. The union has launched a website called Mica Watch, counting down to the next potential shutdown.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
So, Pat Toomey, he did his town hall up in Potter County, up there amongst the trees, and of course all 50 people who live there showed up. It has been told to us, a couple folks who were there, that Toomey was asked about taxing unemployment benefits. And he replied something along the lines of, well, that isn't how the tax code works. So there's a question of whether he knows that we've been taxing unemployment benefits for the last 25 years. And I'm told tomorrow at the town hall they're having over in Carbon County, one of the people that we've got are going to go over there and ask for some clarification. And, you know, part of me goes, you know, how can he not know? And then there's another part, you know, little secret part, that he doesn't really care. He cares about the millionaires and billionaires. He cares about his Wall Street friends. That's it. But the question is, how do we turn that around? How do we get our government working for us again? How do we make an economy that works for us again? That's why I've asked Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's also got a new book out, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Dean, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
You know, I look at this and I you know, people go, well, how could Pat Toomey not know that they're taxing unemployment benefits? And my position is, I don't think he really cares.
That's probably pretty much true. You know, you find a lot of, I can't speak for Pat Toomey, I don't know him, you have a lot of members of Congress, a lot of politicians. They don't live with the rest of us. I mean, they live in a very different world, and, you know, probably very few, if any, of the people he knows are unemployed. It's not their concern. And it wouldn't surprise me that if he's saying that, you know, unemployment benefits aren't taxed, he really may not know.
Yeah, and, you know, I point to the piece that you had in The Nation, why we aren't like Greece, where you say, you know, we got all these people unemployed, underemployed, and there's some folks who, you know, they don't care about the havoc that they've created. All they care about is that every dollar that should be going to Wall Street somehow may be going to the middle class or the poor.
Well, if you look at what's happened over the last three decades, it's kind of incredible because we've had this massive upward redistribution of income, and yet you still have these people complaining about taxes, complaining about regulations. You just go, how much more do you want? And it is a little incredible. I mean, profits are at a record high as a share of GDP. The share of income going to the top 1% or even the smaller group, the top one-tenth of 1%, These are the highest, well, the highest at least since the 20s. Our measurements aren't that good, but they're at the least the highest since the 20s, if not the highest ever. And yet they still want more.
Well, they want it all. I mean, haven't you figured that out? They
want
it all.
I mean, it is a little hard to say anything other than that. I mean, you know, it sounds silly to say, but, you know, how else can you, how could it be your agenda today that you go, oh, the biggest problem is we need more tax cuts?
And you look at how the media structure is, and we see this mass consolidation. We see the voices out there being fewer and fewer, but most of them are marching onto the same pro-corporate business-friendly line that has convinced, I think, a good portion of America that, you know, more tax cuts for the people that we're not calling them wealthy anymore. They're now job creators. That all these job creators are they need this money to create those jobs.
Yeah, you sort of want to say, well, when you start creating the jobs, then we'll talk about giving you more money. You know, but it is really it is incredible. I mean, you know, I'm joking about it, but they, you know, it really is true that they saying they want it all. I don't think that's far from the reality.
But you know, here's the thing. I looked at your book earlier, and I think it's free at your website. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. It's called The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And one of the chapters is this redistribution of wealth upwards. And you're saying it didn't just happen because, you know, I talked to some of my Tea Party friends. And they say, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. And I go, yes, I am. I want to redistribute it back to me where they've taken it from.
Yeah, you know, there's this kind of mythology that I think, unfortunately, a lot of liberals, a lot of progressives have bought into, that sort of this was just, you know, the market working and, you know, we're unhappy with it. We want to see all the money go upward. But it was just, you know, that was the market and that's the way things turned out. What the whole point of this book is, no, it was not just the market. They basically rigged the deck that they controlled trade policy, things like the Federal Reserve Board, monetary policy, with you know, people often refer to as financial deregulation. Well, I always say, no, it wasn't financial deregulation because they still wanted the hand of government. When they were going belly up in the fall of 08, they weren't saying, get the government out. They said, come and save our asses.
Yep.
You know, so it's totally wrong to act like this is just the market. They rigged the deck so all the money would go to them. So that's what we should be talking about. We shouldn't be saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice if you redistribute a little bit of all the money you earned? The point is, don't rig the deck so everything goes up.
Yeah, I agree. But here's the thing. You know, this whole debt ceiling debate, that this whole dog and pony show, this whole, you know, here's the shiny thing, over here, stupid, this whole performance that they put on, not one person did I hear, and maybe you being in Washington heard, not one person was talking about the massive trade deficits we've had with the majority of countries in this world for years, almost a generation.
No, it gets very little play, and, you know, it's really one of these things, you know, I had a post on this on my blog a few days ago, that this is literally just accounting, and, you sort of feel stupid, you know, at least talking among economists to go, you know, remember the stuff we learned in our intro classes? If we have a trade deficit, that means the country as a whole is a net borrower. I mean, it's just definition, you know, that's what it means. If you have a trade deficit, you're a net borrower, which means you either have a government deficit, the public sector is a net borrower, or you have to have the private sector be a net borrower. We'd be back where we were back at the peak of the housing bubble when none of us were saving. We're all borrowing against our homes. So which do you want? You know, so you either have to talk about getting rid of the trade deficit, and if you're not talking about that, well, then someone's got to be borrowing. That's what it means.
But here again, we've got a president in who I voted for and I supported in 2008, who I'm finding more difficult to get behind, pushing three more of these insane Bush-era trade agreements.
Yeah, it's. I mean, what's bizarre is that he's going out there saying that we should be happy about this because they're going to be job creators. You know, we could have an argument. I mean, I'm not going to say that there's no merits to the trade agreements. You could argue some things for them. I mean, I think on the whole they're negative, more negative than positive. But to try and say that they're serious job creators, I mean, that's just not even a serious position. I mean, I know plenty of people support the trade agreement. Trade agreements, who wouldn't say that they're going to create jobs? It's really hard to say that with a straight face. And you just sort of go, why are you telling us this? It's not true. You must know it's not true. You know, again, there are arguments you could make for it, but as job creators, that's just a joke.
Yeah, and the part of it that gets me is, you know, be honest with me. Tell me who you're supporting, because I look at all these trade agreements, and they benefit the investor class. They benefit the financial institutions. They benefit big agribusiness, and they harm the rest of the working class in this country.
That's right, and, you know, this has been the pattern again. What I'll say is these are relatively small agreements. These aren't big countries. They probably won't have that much impact, but they're just not the sort of, this is not, the, it's not going in the right direction.
Right, but at the end of it, what happens, you know, we continue more and more and more, and we've taken, I think at some point, don't we have to change the discussion on this whole free trade model, this whole blind faith religion, that if we just open up markets, everything will be wonderful?
Well, I mean, my view is we've opened up the markets, and it's very hard to close them once they've been open. What I was saying is that we've protected a lot of people. We've protected the high-end wage earners, so doctors, lawyers. They're largely protected. My view is we're not going to reverse, you know, what we've done over the last three decades. It's just, you know, legally it's hard. Practically it'd be very hard. What I'd like to see is open up more and put the people who've been protected, who tend to be the highest-end people, let's put them in competition. We'll get lower-cost health care, lower-cost lawyers. That will be a big benefit for the vast majority of the population because most of us are already facing competition internationally. It's just those at the high end who are still protected.
So the great leveling off by bringing them, maybe having more compression at the top, bringing those folks down.
Well, and it does actually increase the wages. I mean, if we're all paying much less for our doctors, our health care costs us less.
Right, I agree.
The dollars go further. So it's not just, you know, we're making them worse off. We're making ourselves better off if we could get... It's the exact same argument they make. Oh, we're going to get you know, cheap labor from China so we could buy our cars cheaper. Well, that's true. You know, if you pay workers $1 an hour, the, you know, the clothes you buy, whatever, that's going to be less. Same thing is true with doctors. Not that our doctors will get $1 an hour, but, you know, if you lower what doctors get paid, health care will cost less.
Yeah, I can almost see that. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C. He's also written a book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. You can take a look at the PDF copy of it at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Dean Baker's name. It'll take you right to his site. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because Michelle Bachmann has an idea that, you know, if we just do away with the minimum wage, we'd create millions of jobs. So if we lower all that stuff down, you know, eventually... You know, we'll all have jobs, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, it's incredible because, you know, this is such a well-researched topic. And, you know, it's fine to have debates on this, but at this point, it's an old argument that the minimum wage costs jobs. You know, people made it for, you know, I'm sure well into the 19th, maybe even 18th century, so it's not something new. And we've had a lot of chance to test this, and it shows, well, actually, no, it doesn't cost jobs. You know, it doesn't have any measurable impact. Not to say, you know, if you raise the minimum wage enough, you wouldn't end up costing jobs. And I'm sure there's someone somewhere that loses their job. You know, people are always losing jobs, so I'm sure the minimum wage sometimes has been a factor. But it's been a heavily researched topic, and the overwhelming majority of the research finds that, you know, we've had minimum wage hikes and really no evidence to speak of in terms of job loss. But, you know, obviously that's not something that she cares about.
So I'm pointing to the title of your book, How Do We Make Markets More Progressive?
Well, I think basically we try to, the other side, you know, has been working hard to make them less progressive, to have the income redistributed upwards. And what we have to do is find measures that improve the bargaining power of ordinary workers. So, you know, we were talking a moment ago about trade agreements. Another part of that, the dollar, you know, an overvalued dollar makes it very difficult for our workers to compete internationally. So if we had got the dollar down against most currencies around the world, China obviously being an important one, but other currencies as well, that would make it much easier for workers here to compete. Patent protection is something people don't talk about a lot, but we pay almost $300 billion a year for prescription drugs. If these were sold without patent protection, sold in the free market, we'd be paying about $30 billion. So that's about $270 billion a year. That's about five times the size of the Bush tax cuts to the wealthy, and it's not even discussed. So there's a lot of things like that, if you look at it closely, that have income going to high-end earners, to the richest people in the country from the rest of our pockets, that don't really serve any good purpose.
So would you suggest maybe a progressive income tax? Would you suggest some other ways of because I gotta think going back to a more rational tax code other than continually lower, has got to do something to help our deficits and help our debt.
Well, I think that is part of the story. I mean, we are at some point, I don't think we need to do anything about the deficit, the budget deficit today. But over time, we will. And, you know, one of the things we probably want to do is more progressive taxes. You were talking a moment ago about taxing financial speculation on Wall Street. That could raise a lot of money. You know, that's something that I think would be very good, both because we could raise money that way, but also because we wouldn't have so much of our resources being diverted to Wall Street. All these people who are making, you know, huge seven, even eight-figure salaries, basically just shuffling around financial assets.
Yeah, because you know, in looking at these deficits and the whole dog and pony show that went on, is the deficit spending that we're doing now that dangerous? Because I got to be honest with you. I think by doing what we've done so far with the debates that they had and this committee that's going to pull a whole boatload of money out of the economy, I can only see the economy going down. I can only see us having more trouble and this recession lasting. Because I got to tell you, I think we're still in a recession. And I know people who think it's a depression because they can't find jobs. There are no jobs out there for.
No, it's a pretty horrible situation, and, you know, the whole point, and here I really blame Obama somewhat for not being, you know, a better spokesperson for his own policies, but, you know, we really need the deficits. We need stimulus, and that means running deficits right now. Well, you know, in principle, at some point in the future, we'll be closer to full employment. We won't need a deficit to support the economy, but that's the reality. The private sector collapsed. We had a housing bubble driving the economy. That bubble burst, so we lost hundreds of billions of dollars in construction demand. We lost hundreds of billions of dollars in consumption demand based on people spending against the equity in their homes. And there's nothing to replace it. I mean, I talk to these people all the time, the conservatives, and I go, well, we want the private sector. I go, fine, I want the private sector too, but that doesn't matter. They're not about to replace that demand. So in the meantime, we need the government. We need budget deficits. That's actually what's supporting the economy.
Do you think the Recovery Act, did it work? I tend to claim that it wasn't big enough, it wasn't targeted properly, that there were more that we could have done to put people back to work. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, it did work for what it was, but you're exactly right. It wasn't big enough. And again, here's something that people have done some fairly careful research on it, and they find, you know, President Obama predicted it would create 2 to 3 million jobs, and that's more or less what they find. You know, there's room to quibble on what the exact numbers are, but you know, 2 to 3 million jobs is good, but the problem was we needed somewhere around 10 to 12 million.
Right.
So, you know, I'm happy we got 2 to 3 million. That's really good. We'd be in certainly a worse situation. You know, the unemployment rate would be, you know, 10.5, 11% today. So, you know, I'm happy for 9.1 rather than 10.5, 11, but no one could be happy about 9.1.
Right. What do you think is going to come out of this job speech he's going to have the 7th or 8th whenever they're done quibbling over the date?
Well, I'm not optimistic. I mean, I really worry that he's backed himself into a corner. I mean, I really wish he'd be prepared to say, look, we made a mistake in not being bold and not putting forward a bigger plan. Now we're going to reverse that. You know, and I understand the Republicans won't go along with it, but if you don't at least put it on the table, you're not going to get anywhere. And if you do put it on the table, you can at least make it clear. Here's what we're about. Here's how we would turn the economy around. They don't want to let us. And I really hope that. I can't say I'm anticipating it, but that would be my dream.
Yeah, because I look at all of this Republican rhetoric that we need to cut spending, and somehow cutting spending is going to create jobs. And I got to be honest, you know, I'm not an economist like you, and you know, I listen to some of these other folks on the right who claim that, you know, if we cut enough spending, if we cut, it's going to create all these jobs. And I'm just not seeing it. I'm sorry.
Well, it's hard to even understand the logic. You sort of go, okay, so. I mean, you think about the different businesses. You know, you have a restaurant, you have a factory, you know, you have a grocery store. Which one of these businesses is going to hire people because the government's cut jobs? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. You're sitting there with your restaurant and, you know, the government just laid off, your city or state government just laid off a few thousand workers. You go, wow, that's a great idea. I'll go out and hire more. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know, there is an argument if, you know, again, if we're at an economy that we're near full employment and, you know, things are kind of bursting at the seams, and then
right.
You go, okay, well, the government laid off workers, reducing demand, that could lower interest rates, and the business go, okay, it's a good time for me to borrow, and now I'll expand and this and that. You could tell that story, and not to say that's always going to be that compelling, but that's at least the story I could understand. But why on earth, when you're in the middle of a downturn, are businesses going to go, oh, that's great, government just laid off a lot of workers, I'm going to go out and hire? It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And the last question I've got for you, you know, you talked about interest rates there for a second, and that, you know, people see lower interest rates and that they're going to invest in their businesses. Have we seen that? Because I don't know that we can get much lower with the interest rates. You know, I think it was one of the railroads borrowed a quarter of $1 billion for the next 100 years at almost no interest. And I wonder, you know, how can I get that?
You know, interest rates have a modest effect on investment in normal times. In the current environment where most businesses have so much excess capacity, it's a very weak way to boost the economy. I'm not going to say zero, but, you know, as you say, interest rates are already very low. Do we really think they'll go much lower? I mean, I suppose they could always go a little lower. Is that going to have much impact on business investment? It's really hard to see.
Yeah. Again, the book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We've got a link to a free PDF that Dean Baker's put out for you to take a look at. Just click on Dean Baker's name. It'll take you right there. Dean, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. Or working people come to talk.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Have you found it necessary to declare on national television that, quote, I am a serious person? You're probably not. Meet Michelle Bachmann. She's currently running for president, but suffering a few credibility problems. One is that she keeps creating her own fanciful version of history. For example, she recently bewildered Iowa voters by asserting that the Founding Fathers had magnanimously included every American in the nation's new government. Quote, it didn't matter the color of people's skin, she marveled. It didn't matter whether they were of a higher class or a lower class. It made no difference. Seriously? Indeed, Bachmann plowed straight ahead into a fantasy about the founders' glorious work to free the slaves. She insisted that these wealthy, white, slave-owning men, quote, worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States. Seriously? No surprise, then, that the Congresswoman also invents her own personal history. While she unsparingly attacks Washington's spending addiction, she apparently doesn't own a mirror. It turns out that her husband's counseling clinic has received thousands of dollars in state and federal grants. Oh, she dodges, those tax dollars didn't come to us. Seriously? Yes, she explains, the money went to train our clinic's employees, as though that's not a subsidy for their business. Then there is the $260,000 in subsidies for her family's farm. Oh, she dissembled, that went to my father-in-law, adding that I have never gotten a penny from the farm. Seriously? But wait, she's listed as a partner in the farm, and her financial disclosure forms report that, in fact, she has received $105,000 in income from it. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bachmann says she wants to take government back. And in all seriousness, it looks like she's already clawing back her piece of it.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. I really like Dean Baker. He's one of those guys, I think, just he's an excellent, excellent guy. And again, the book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. He's put it online. You can read it on a PDF. Just go to therickSmithShow.com and click on Dean Baker's name. It's well worth the read. I'm going to get through it here by the end of the day tomorrow, I promise. Our quote of the day comes from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog, Chuck Collins, co-author of Executive Excess 2011. We're going to talk to his co-author a little bit later in the program. He says, instead of sharing responsibility for addressing our nation's fiscal challenges, corporations are rewarding CEOs for aggressive tax avoidance, which means they're lining their pockets. And do we expect anything else? I mean, would you expect any less? I wouldn't. So here's the thing. Uh-oh, big trouble. Big trouble in the Republican controlled the little cabal they got going on there. They had it all tight. They had everybody there. But Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, kind of breaking away from the pack, said, my concern is that we help people in need. He says, for the FEMA money that's going to flow, it's up to them on how they're going to get it. I don't think it's time to get into that whole deficit debate. It needs to get here. And double uh-oh. NorthNewJersey.com reports that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is saying, you know, our people are suffering now and they need support now. And Congress can go down there and get back to work and figure out how their budget cuts later. He said, we need support now. Now here in New Jersey, and that's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. And again, you know, this is what I think we have to be hammering on the fact that the Republicans, the leadership wants to cut these people off. Oh, we can give you a little bit, you know, a little bit here, but we'll have to take it from somebody else. Again, pitting us against one another. They're masters at that. Representative David Swikert, Republican from Arizona, budget cuts must be a prerequisite, he said, for any disaster aid in order to reassure the business markets. We need to make the business markets happy. We need to make them happy. Pete Roskam, Republican from Illinois, the days when disaster relief could be funded without offsetting budget cuts are gone. And our own Pat Toomey, said that Cantor's cuts are reasonable. And I got to be honest, I don't know that reasonable. I don't know that reasonable is something I would put in a sentence with a Republican at this point, especially when you look at what's going on. And I'm kind of frustrated over this whole thing. The whole message machine behind the radical right is, we're going to have to steal from Granny, or we're going to have to steal from education to help those people. And it's nuts, Jake. It's just plain nuts. But it could be a good campaign issue.
Well, I believe it just 'cause it goes counter to the, you know, the American spirit of rallying around as a nation, as a people in time of national calamity. We've done that. We've done that the whole history of this country. And for them now to try to go against it, I think that's a losing issue for them. It might appeal to their base. It might be a temporary victory, but I believe it's without question, Rick, long-term a losing issue for the Republicans.
Yep. So the president wants to give a big speech, wants to give a big job speech, talk about how he's going to get the economy back going. So he wants to do it on September 7th, which I guess is a Wednesday. John Boehner says, no, that doesn't work for us. We've checked our calendar, and it doesn't work for us. You can do it tomorrow, though. We'd be happy to let you do that tomorrow, Mr. President, Mr. Most Powerful Man in the Free World. No. And I look at this and I go, this is, after all, the president of the United States. Can you imagine? I mean, stop and think about this for a second. As much as I didn't like George W. Bush, I can't imagine telling him, no, doesn't work for us. No, Mr. President, you can't come. It doesn't work for us. That's how far these people have gone in their arrogance, how far they've gone in their self-centeredness, that they have this thought that they rule the roost and they can disrespect the office. And even when Bush was president, there were people who, I said, just went too far. And I wonder, next term, how bad is it going to get? And how bad does this stuff have to get before the adults in the room, hopefully all of us, grow up and say, you know what? The office is what it is. And we should give respect to that office. And if he wants to come before Congress and give a speech, we sit there respectfully. Is that too much to ask? I don't think so. Anyway, today the president was out with an odd couple, if you will. Rich Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, along with a representative of Dave Chevron, a representative of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, their chief operating officer, were basically side by side with Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, a Republican, and the president saying, hey, we need a job. We need this jobs bill to go through. We need this highway bill. We need the FAA bill. And I was reading through some of the things that the president had proposed, and he's saying, look, we would like to have a $556 billion highway bill over the next 6 years, spread it out over the next 6 years, and start rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. And I started looking at some of the other plans. The Republicans in the House, you know, they've got their grand plan, how they're going to get our transportation needs under control. $230 billion over 6 years. 30% less than we're currently spending. So again, we're whacking off 30% of the transportation bill at a time when our transportation systems are crumbling before our very eyes. Now, the Democrats in the Senate, they're no friend either, really. They're talking about a 2-year, $109 billion funding bill. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, I gotta be honest, I'd like to see more. I'd like to see chunky. I would like to see big. I would like to see bold. I would like to see somebody say, you know what, we're going to make sure that those roads are paved, those bridges are secure, and that we start looking at how we're going to move people in the 21st century. You know, I would love nothing more than to be able to hop on a train and get to work. So I don't have to come into town and pay for parking. I don't have to worry about getting tickets all the time. I don't have to worry about upkeep on my car. It would be, for me, a good thing. And I think from a lot of other workers. And that's going to take some planning. And I know that, you know, Republicans are really dead set against planning, having a vision of what tomorrow will look like, but we're going to have to do some of that. This hodgepodgery, this the invisible hand will take care of it, hasn't worked so far. And, you know, I didn't get to talk with Dean Baker about these P3s that they keep trying to throw at us. More me holding the risk and them taking the rewards. But that seems to be where we're heading. To me, it's more shifting responsibility. It's more redistribution of wealth. It's more stealing from you and me, the working people, and handing upward. And, you know, again, you know, the president of the AFL-CIO was standing there with the guy from the Chamber of Commerce. This is, you know, you want bipartisan support? I don't know how much more bipartisan you can get. The two of them, I would have to say, you probably couldn't put them in a room on any other issue, I don't think. Can you think of anything else that they would agree on? Because I can't.
No.
You know, you look at this and I go, eh. So then the Chamber of Commerce, you know, and again, you know, you can't be surprised by this stuff. They're standing there with the president of the AFL-CIO, Rich Trumka, the president of the United States, and they're saying, yes, we want a transportation bill. That's a good start. Well, they unveiled their own jobs package afterward based on infrastructure spending, developing domestic energy, more of their insane trade deals, and you guessed it, the main point, deregulation. That's right, more deregulation. Because evidently we haven't deregulated enough for them. And, you know, I look at this and I go, well, when does this whole deregulation thing end? When does the assault on my air and my water, when does that end? And I guess for them, never. Because according to the business community, there's no such thing as a good regulation. They're all job killers, all job-killing regulations. Well, what about the people killing deregulation? What about all of those things, all of those products? You remember, you know, back when the Chinese sent in that dog food with the melamine in it? That we didn't have any regulation in place to make sure that we checked all of that stuff coming in? Thousands of people's pets died. Nah, that's just a bunch of dogs. We don't care about that. What about the toothpaste that came in from China that had antifreeze in it? Don't know about that. But here again, you know, you stop and you look at these regulations, man. They're killers. They're destroying us. They're destroying the country. And I come from an area, you know, I'm very honest about it, came from Cleveland, home of the Clean Water and Clean Air Act. You could actually cut Lake Erie with a knife. It was that kind of filthy, that kind of polluted, that kind of dirty. You weren't allowed to swim in it. I think if you jumped in it, you would probably have tumors within an hour.
And the president at that time was Mr. Watergate, President Richard Nixon. When you look at it in the prism of history, I mean, Richard Nixon would be actually a saint as compared to some of these right-wing presidents that we've had in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, Richard Nixon did some decent things. Of course, at that time, he had a strong labor movement to deal with. George Meany, by all accounts, could literally pick up his phone and call the White House at any time. But at that time, that was in the halcyon days of labor. That was in the 60s. And there was different times. And Richard Nixon, you know, had a counterforce with labor. We do not have that anymore, at least to the degree that we need to have it.
Yeah, and I look at this whole push on deregulation, and I go, how bad does it have to get? You know, how much further do we have to get? And, you know, I've been watching the right wing lose their mind over, you know, you're talking about labor, the right wing's losing their mind over the fact that, you know, there have been a couple decisions that have returned us to some rational labor policy. A lot of the stuff that was done during the Bush years that really went after attacking workers now being looked at and saying, you know what, that was, we need to fix that stuff. We need to correct it because that's not how the history of the law was supposed to be. And the right, they're losing their mind by having to post a very simple thing saying, you know what, you have the right to join a labor union if you so choose. I don't know what's wrong with that. But the radical right, they're just they're just off their rocker here because they've got their hands so firmly on the wheel that they don't want to give up any control. It's you know, just one of those things. I just laugh. It's amazing stuff to me.
And the political axiom is, Rick, and it's so true: power only accedes to power.
But this jobs discussion he wants to have on the 7th or the 8th or the 9th or 10th or wherever, because I do think he's going to probably cave and pick another day. Because, you know, heaven forbid we miss the Republican debate on the 7th or football on the 8th, because, you know, that was kind of the political back and forth here. There are those who think, well, the president did it because he wants to be in the middle of the debate. And there are some folks who are saying, let's put it over into football so we tick off all those Green Bay Packer fans and get Wisconsin back on our side. And look at that. I mean, even this is political. You can't just have a speech. But in having the discussion of what we should be doing, I think it's pretty simple. You need to start building things. You need to start investing things, and that's going to cost resources. It's going to cost money. And by having these committees saying, we're going to go and we're going to cut, how are you going to be able to afford this? And the part of it is, and this is a beautiful, masterful plan by the right wing, well, you don't have the money, we're going to have to cut it. You're going to have to get private investment. You're going to have to get Wall Street to come in and build your roads and bridges. You're going to have to get Wall Street to come in and fund your education. You're going to have to get Wall Street to come in and do all of those things that government used to do back when my grandfather was working, back in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, back then when we used to have money to invest or we had the will to invest. Now what we have to do is, well, we've got to beg Wall Street. And in that begging process, like Donna Cooper said the other night, they want their money. They want the opportunity costs of investing it somewhere else. They want it up front. They want it in their pocket. They want low interest rates. They want deregulation. They want no labor laws. They want no prevailing wage rates. Hell, they don't even want minimum wage. They want it all. And like Dean Baker said, you know, how much is enough? How much do they need? And you look at this Jeffrey Immelt, the jobs czar, his company GE. They announced about a week ago that they're going to up and move their X-ray division out of Waukesha, Wisconsin, which I got to laugh. That really, you know, the whole idea that big business is, you know, in the pocket of the Republicans or vice versa, I find it interesting that they're moving it out of Waukesha, Wisconsin. Which, you know, Waukesha, as we know, is extremely right-wing, basically cost labor the vote there, if you remember the 14,000 votes that the woman ended up taking with her from Waukesha. They're moving, you know, all these jobs out of Waukesha, a place that they've been for, I think, almost 100 years, if I remember right, 115 years, and they're moving to China. Why? Well, they're moving their investment over there. They're moving their stuff over there. And I just kind of, I got to be honest, I kind of just shake my head and go, these are the policies that we've been pushing. This is the direction that we've allowed our trade policies to take us. And it's frustrating. Because these jobs supported families. And now that they're gone. And you look at, you know, I went back home to Cleveland, and I've talked about this before. The factories that used to support families gone because of our trade policies. And then Dean Baker talks about it in his book, The High Dollar Policy, that cost us a boatload of jobs. How do we turn that around? How do we make it a more progressive environment? It starts with, you know, and it starts with us. It starts with each one of us. And I think about Labor Day coming up. You know, instead of being at each other's throats, we should be pulling together. Instead of pointing fingers at each other and saying, well, you know, the teabaggers, is far off on the extreme as they are. There are things that we've got to be able to agree on. The fact that we need a manufacturing base, I think, is one of them. The fact that every job in this country should pay a reasonable living wage so that people can support themselves. You know, the Michelle Bachmans and the radicals on the extreme right are going, well, 46-47% of the people pay no taxes, no federal taxes, nothing. They pay zero. Could it be that they don't make enough money to pay any taxes? Could that be the problem? You know what I'm in favor of? I'm in favor of taxing all 47% of them, making sure that every one of them pay taxes. I'm in favor of that, yes, by having wages high enough that would let them. You know, I got to be honest. I would love to pay high tax rates because that means I'm making big money. But our investor class friends, they don't think that way. They think of, I'd like to pocket the rest of it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Scott Klinger about his piece, Executive Excess, the Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. From Maine to California tomorrow, nurses are converging on 60 congressional offices in 21 states to call for a tax on Wall Street to pay for the economic healing of our nation. Union RNs will sponsor soup kitchens and food pantries as they speak out on the need for jobs, health care, education, and housing. National Nurses United says the message is that Americans are hurting and they need jobs, a secure retirement, and no more austerity cuts. Nurses are asking members of Congress to sign a pledge to support a Wall Street transaction tax that will raise sufficient revenue to make Wall Street pay for the devastation that it's caused on Main Street. National Nurses United says a Wall Street tax on the very speculative financial activities that caused the 2008 financial meltdown could raise hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for the programs desperately needed to reduce the pain and suffering working families are still feeling. As the United Auto Workers Union tries to reach a new contract with the Detroit Three automakers, workers at Ford are voting on a strike authorization in case one is needed. Ford's 41,000 UAW workers are the only Detroit auto workers who can still strike, if necessary. Ford workers want a raise, the restoration of their cost of living allowances, and higher starting wages for the entry-level workers who earn just half of what veteran UAW members make. The Detroit Three auto contracts expire September 14th. UAW President Bob King says concessions and givebacks by the union to help save the U.S. auto industry has cost auto workers between $7,000 and $30,000 each over the life of the contract. The Communications Workers of America aren't waiting until Congress reconvenes to start the battle over funding for the Federal Aviation Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
Republicans have been unwilling to permanently reauthorize funding for FAA programs due to opposition to a new mediation rule they fear would make it easier for airline employees to form unions. The last time the GOP stone resulted in a shutdown of portions of the FAA, costing the government nearly $400 million. It saw more than 75,000 employees, both FAA employees and construction workers, furloughed without pay. If the Republicans return to Congress with the desire to play games with jobs, it could result in a shutdown as soon as September 16th. The CWA has launched mailers and robocalls, encouraging taxpayers to pressure their representatives to pass a clean FAA reauthorization bill. One of the primary targets of the CWA is House Transportation Committee Chairman John Mica of Florida. The union has launched a website called Mica Watch, counting down to the next potential shutdown.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The WIN, who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Well, diving for their tax shelters, they sure have been. And I look at this new report out by the Institute for Policy Studies, Executive Excess, the massive CEO rewards for tax dodging. And I just go, what more does it take? What more is it going to take for us to wake up and demand our representatives to do something? Anything, do something. At least acknowledge it. That's why I've asked Scott Klinger. He's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, also a co-author of the report, Executive Excess. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick. How are you?
I'm good, but I look at this, and I got to be honest, there's no surprise here. In fact, of the 100 CEOs you looked at, 25 to me seems low.
Well, you know, we first got interested in this issue last year when we noticed that one of the companies among the top paid CEOs paid their CEO more than they did in taxes. And we were pretty astonished at that. So we kept our eye open as this year's numbers started rolling out back in the spring, CEO pay numbers. And we were pretty taken by the 25 number. But yes, it's consistent with other reports that have been done. There was another study done earlier this year that didn't name names, but it said, I believe 160 of the S&P 500 companies paid their CEOs more than they did in in taxes, federal taxes.
And you look at that dog and pony show that went on, the discussion about the we've got this debt ceiling problem, and all the country's going to come to a screeching halt. We're broke. We don't have any money. We can't possibly. Now they're saying we can't possibly respond to Hurricane Irene, and we're going to have to make desperate cuts from other places. And I look at this and I go, there's a perfect spot to go get a bunch of money from.
That's absolutely right. There is a ton of money that's not being paid by large and very profitable corporations. Furthermore, just this attitude of cutting not only hurts people hurt in hurricanes and, you know, people in normal communities, it hurts corporations because the government has been a major driver of investing in things that make corporations competitive, things like basic research and things like good schools. One of the things we looked at in this report was the education that the CEOs themselves got, and we found that 16 of the 25 themselves went to public colleges or universities. And yet they don't see a need for their companies to pay back and to keep those educational institutions healthy.
Pretty amazing. You know what I hear? I hear people tell me, well, why do you care about what the CEOs are making? It doesn't cost you anything. It's not coming out of your pocket. And I say, everything eventually comes out of my pocket. One way or another, we pay for it as consumers. The same stuff that they talk about allowing workers to organize. Oh, that's just going to raise the cost of things. Yes, but at least the money goes into people's pockets who are working.
Right. The gap has grown wider and wider, and this year the gap between the average CEO and the average worker was 325-1. Just for comparison, last year that number was 263-1, and the average S&P 500 CEO received a 27% compensation rise in 2010 over 2009.
Wow, good for them. It sounds like there's no recession in their neighborhood.
No, and that's part of the problem is that more and more is flowing to the top, whether it's the wealthiest corporations or the wealthiest families and individuals. And the reality is that what people should really be upset about is not only do the middle class have less, but the middle class is picking up the tab and the taxes for corporations that aren't paying their fair share.
What were some of the companies that you looked at? I know GE being one of them. They've been in the news because actually not only did they not pay any taxes, we actually gave them money. Please, thank you for giving us the jobs here. We'll pay you for the privilege of working for you.
That's right. They got a credit back of about $3 billion. Some of the other companies on the list of the companies that paid their CEOs more than they paid in taxes are Bank of New York Mellon, Verizon, Dow Chemical, Honeywell, Boeing, and a number of others.
Honeywell, the company that kept those guys out in Metropolis, Illinois, out on strike for, or locked out, I'm sorry, not on strike, locked out for over a year because how dare they want health care benefits for their retirees and how dare they want a meager raise?
Well, their CEO last year made $15.2 million. So.
And what did they pay in taxes?
They got $471 million back.
So, again, another company that we pay for the privilege of working for them.
Yes.
That's beautiful.
And they reported U.S. profits of over $1.2 billion.
Wow. For my anti-government people, because I've got a number of anti-government folks listening to the program, a lot of these companies, they make their profit off of government, correct?
Boeing's a great example of that, where it's one of the largest federal contractors. And Boeing actually did pay some taxes last year, although a very small amount. They paid $13 million in taxes. They reported $4.3 billion in U.S. profits. So very, very small, less than 1% of their profits went into federal income taxes.
And, you know, I look at this and this tax holiday that people keep talking about, I keep hearing the Republicans throwing out this idea of, we need to be able to repatriate all of that money that's overseas because, you know, we can give it to the job creators and the job creators can put it to work. Much like it did the last time when it didn't create any jobs and it just enriched the handful at the top. But again, we keep hearing this frame. If we could just bring that money back, I'm thinking about that and I look at your study and I say, you know, to be honest, I think it would just make that situation worse.
Well, it absolutely would. The tax holiday last time was a job killer and this time would be even more of a job killer. One of the reasons is because it has trained companies to just accelerate the amount of money and jobs that they shift overseas. After the 2004 tax holiday, we saw a dramatic increase in the foreign offshore holdings of many of the large corporations. And many of the companies took their tax holiday and ended up laying off workers almost immediately. And in that group would be Pfizer, Merck, and Hewlett-Packard, who each had big layoffs after taking the big tax breaks in 2004.
Wow, you know, that's the kind of policy we need more of, to make sure that our billionaire class is robust and strong while the rest of us are struggling for crumbs.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. And, you know, one of the things people ask, how does this happen? And one of the things we focus on in this report is the amount of money the companies spend on lobbying. So of the 25 companies that paid their CEOs more than they paid Uncle Sam, 20 of them also spent more money lobbying Congress than they paid in corporate taxes. And 18 of them gave more to political campaigns of their favorite federal candidates than they paid to the IRS. So it's really the rules are being written in favor of those who already have economic and political power, and the rest of us are getting treated very unfairly.
And the messaging that I hear, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the messaging that I'm hearing is, well, we have got the second highest tax rate in the entire world. There's only one other country, Japan, who has a higher tax rate than us. But I look at this, and I got to be honest, I'm just not seeing that high tax rate.
Well, kind of two ways to look at that. One is the average corporation pays about 11% of its income in taxes, not the 35%. That's the kind of the retail rate. And the other thing is U.S. corporate taxes as a percent of the economy are among the lowest in the industrial world. All of our major competitors take more money in from corporations to fund their government and as a part of their overall economy. So the fact that U.S. corporations are overtaxed is a very strong myth. Companies do move their money to places like the Cayman Islands and Luxembourg and other tax havens where there are very low or no taxes. But often those subsidiaries are nothing more than a post office box and a satellite dish and a brass plate on a wall with thousands of other companies that are sharing the same office.
Yeah, like the building in the Cayman Islands that has
11,000 corporations in it and no employees.
Yeah, so. That's beautiful. So let me ask you this, Scott Klinger. How do we turn this around? I mean, we know this information and you know, it should come as no surprise to the majority of us that the CEO classes has recovered. They've bounced back. Wall Street's fat and happy again. How do we make Main Street fat and happy? How do we get average Joe Sixpack to be able to put an extra buck in his pocket every now and again?
Well, one of the things we can certainly do is to follow the call of Warren Buffett a couple of weeks ago when he called for the taxes to be raised on the millionaire class. You know, often people are confused and think that small business are the millionaires in this country, but it's really the CEOs of corporations and others like them that are the people who are enjoying the biggest tax cuts under the Bush tax cuts from 2001. And the other thing we can do is a piece of very important legislation that was just introduced in both the House and the Senate called the Stop Tax Havens Abuse Act. This would make it the tax haven thing, the post office boxes and satellite dish thing I talked about a second ago, would no longer be allowed. Companies wouldn't be allowed to have shell corporations, subsidiaries that existed primarily for the purpose of avoiding taxes. So those are two important things that we can demand of our elected officials. And, you know, I think the other thing is just to help spread the word to others and educate people, because, as you said, a lot of people are really sucked in by this idea that if we bring this money home from overseas, that it'll suddenly create jobs. That didn't work last time, and it's not going to work again. And yet companies are very, very successful in getting this before Congress, and we expect Congress to take this issue up.
Yeah, they spend an awful lot of money making sure that they get their way.
Yeah, and they've hired, I think, 18 lobbyists, and a lot of them are former congressional staff members and in some cases congressional elected officials. So, you know, it's a pretty wired lobbying effort, and they certainly have the relationships. But we hope with more of the people power on our side that we can prevail.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope everybody takes a look at this report. It's called Executive Excess, the Massive CEO Rewards for Tax Dodging. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Scott Klingler's name. He's an associate fellow over at the Institute for Policy Studies. Scott, always great to talk with you. I appreciate your time. And this is a useful, a very good report.
Thanks so much, Rick, and thanks for your efforts.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
If you find it necessary to declare on national television that, quote, I am a serious person, you're probably not. Meet Michelle Bachmann. She's currently running for president, but suffering a few credibility problems. One is that she keeps creating her own fanciful version of history. For example, she recently bewildered Iowa voters by asserting that the Founding Fathers had magnanimously included every American in the nation's new government. Quote, it didn't matter the color of people's skin, she marveled. It didn't matter whether they were of a higher class or a lower class. It made no difference. Seriously? Indeed, Bachmann plowed straight ahead into a fantasy about the founders' glorious work to free the slaves. She insisted that these wealthy, white, slave-owning men, quote, worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States. Seriously. No surprise, then, that the Congresswoman also invents her own personal history. While she unsparingly attacks Washington's spending addiction, she apparently doesn't own a mirror. It turns out that her husband's counseling clinic has received thousands of dollars in state and federal grants. Oh, she dodges, those tax dollars didn't come to us. Seriously? Yes, she explains, the money went to train our clinic's employees, as though that's not a subsidy for their business. Then there is the $260,000 in subsidies for her family's farm. Oh, she dissembled, that went to my father-in-law, adding that I have never gotten a penny from the farm. Seriously? But wait, she's listed as a partner in the farm, and her financial disclosure forms report that, in fact, she has received $105,000 in income from it. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bachmann says she wants to take government back. And in all seriousness, it looks like she's already clawing back her piece of it.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin' but the weight is. Everything's raisin' but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin' but the weight is.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel in the news. Evidently, he did an interview with the folks over at the Financial Times. And not happy with his Republican colleagues. In fact, called their leadership irresponsible. The whole debt debacle thing really, I think, caught him. He said, I think about some of the presidents we've had on my side of the aisle, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., go right through them, Eisenhower. They would be stunned, Hagel says. He said he was disgusted with the debt ceiling negotiations and called it an astounding lack of responsible leadership by many in the Republican Party. And he said, I say that as a Republican. He goes on to say, does anyone not believe what's happened here the last couple of weeks in the market was not a complete direct result of the lack of confidence that came out of that folly, that embarrassment? He was asked about the Tea Party, and Hagel jumped in and said, you know, they've captured the Republican Party. It's a narrow, very ideological, very narrow movement. He said, you know, I've never seen so much intolerance as I've seen today. He went on to say later that the 2012 Republican field may need to rebuild, agreeing that they are now too far to the right. Now, there was a point where Hagel, you know, seemed a little bit at the beginning to the right. He kind of stayed, and the party kept moving to where eventually he was a moderate. But at the beginning there, he was, you know, a little bit off. But I look at this whole debate over the time, and I got to tell you, I think we're screwed. I mean, Republicans won't even agree to allow the guy to speak. What a fiasco! I think I have a new favorite governor, a guy named Daniel Malloy, the Democrat up in Connecticut, who was asked about Ron Paul and, you know, some of the things he's been saying about FEMA, and he said, I think he's an idiot. pretty blunt, pretty to the point. I actually made the CNN woman laugh a little bit. She says, you know, he went on to say, we're spending some $900 million a week in wars, and he, being Ron Paul, is arguing about whether we should spend some money. FEMA now currently has $900 million in its budget available. This is a ridiculous conversation. Really don't understand what he's talking about. And he said, I'm not sure he does. Not sure he knows what he's talking about. He went on to say, the reality is that this storm was handled in such a way that we preserved hundreds of lives. Without this warning system, without this system of response, we would not be standing here with as few people who have died in this massive storm that stretches from North Carolina to Quebec. And, you know, he's right. And he's someone who said, look, I'm going to defend FEMA. They do their job. They do what they're supposed to do. And you're not going to get any of that out of me.
And by the way, did you catch Ron Paul's comment about FEMA and how, what was it, Corpus Christi, when they had that the great flood back in the early 90s, how efficient they were? He forgot to mention one thing. There were 7,000 people that died in that flood, and it took them, by all accounts, they literally had to burn the bodies, and it took them over a week to burn all those 7,000 people that died. So much for cities doing it on their own without federal help.
Yeah, well, that's the world he wants to live in. You've got to understand what he's saying. He wants to live in a world where basically you're on your own. Hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. And that's fine being in the position that he is in. The vast majority of people, that kind of a society doesn't work. And I look at what's going on in Vermont. Vermont is having some real problems right now. They're in tough straits. And you look at the reality that all of its helicopters are in Iraq. They've actually had to borrow from other states to respond to the hurricane. They had evidently six Black Hawk helicopters for their National Guard, and they are all in Iraq, as is a good number of their soldiers. And, you know, I went to the National Guard website. I went to NationalGuard.com. And, I said, gee, what's the National Guard's mission? And one of the things it says is the Guard answers the call at home and abroad. The incredible versatility of the National Guard enables troops to respond to domestic emergencies, combat missions, counter-drug efforts, reconstruction missions, and more with equal speed, strength, and efficiency. Whether the call is coming from the state governor or directly from the president, Guard soldiers are always ready and always there. Goes on to say, as a Guard soldier, you can expect your primary area of operation to be your home state. Following the leadership of your state adjutant general or the governor, this may include community efforts, responding to wildfires or floods. And, you know, I look at this and I go, where are all our National Guard troops? Where are those people? Where are the people who are supposed to respond to this stuff? And, you know, Ron Paul talks about all these volunteers. Well, that's what we have. We've got this national defense that happens to be here for just such an emergency. When we have these crises, we have people to call up and say, okay, now we got to get to work. Problem is, we've got ourselves tied up in everything else except what's right here and what's at home. We've done such a masterful job of sticking our nose in everybody else's business that when it comes time for us to deal with our own, we're now begging other people for stuff. I mean, you look at Vermont, who, you know, after talking with somebody today, you know, they're still underwater, man. And it's just nuts. You know, I listen to the Cantors of the world. I listen to the Republicans of the world. We're broke. We're just too broke to respond. Sorry. We're going to have to steal it from somewhere else. And I look at the fact that the people over at the Center for American Progress, Michael Linden, the director of their tax and budget policy, you know, he's come out and said, look, if we had a do-nothing Congress, if we just had Congress say, you know, just go home, go take a vacation, go, just go, and they did nothing, nothing, no fiscal policies, nothing between now and January of 2013, the federal budget deficit would dwindle down to just 1.6% of gross domestic product. By 2014, it would continue to drop. And they're saying the debt as the share of GDP by 2013 would be down to 73%, and in 2021 would drop down to 61%. If we did nothing, nothing at all, let the Bush tax cuts go, let the handouts go, let that expire and begin taxing again, trigger the spending cuts that are going to come from the debt ceiling debacle, go with that, and then do things that Congress always puts off. Let those come true, like the alternative minimum tax that they keep pushing down the road. You know, heaven forbid our millionaires have to pay something. And, you know, I look at that, and we have millionaires not paying anything, and all I hear the right screaming about is, well, you got 46% of the people paying no federal taxes. And I don't really have a problem with that because they don't have the money. My problem is you got these millionaires and billionaires who pay no taxes, and these big multinational corporations, like we talked about with Scott Klinger there, who we end up paying them for the privilege of working for them while they're making profit. And look, this whole thing, all this that's going on, we know what the end game is. We've known it for a long time. It's to steal Social Security. It's to privatize that. It's to privatize all of what is ours. Then we hand that over to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And I look at Chuck Grassley, who did a town hall not too long ago. And someone asked him about Social Security. And it kind of caught my, his response kind of caught my eye. The question was, I want to know what you're going to do to strengthen Social Security to make it so that we don't ever have to worry about whether or not the stock market is going to go south, the banks are going to get bailed out, and I get nothing. So Grassley's response is, first of all, he says, I've already answered the first question. Everything's on the table. Everything's there. Got to have it all on the table. Secondly, I only know one member of Congress out of 535, and I won't name him, but I only know one member of 535 who wants to privatize Social Security. One guy, that's all he knows. Just one person, that's it. Just one lonely soul. So who could that one member be? Who could that one soul character be, that single solitary conspirator, that one un-American? Actually turns out to be Chuck Grassley himself, along with just about all of the rest of the Republican Senate. You may remember Chuck Grassley as the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee back in 2005. He was one of the people leading the push towards privatization. And the folks over at Think Progress turned up a list of about 118 other Republicans in the House and Senate who were on the record supporting Social Security privatization. So just one, that's all, just one. There's just one person, nobody else. And you look at the list, it's every Republican in the Senate who signed on to this back in 2007. They tried to ram this through, and they lost. It was 40. The vote was 45-52, but they wanted those private accounts. They were pushing hard. DeMint had his proposal out there. They were pushing hard. And fortunately, it didn't happen. Because you remember, Bush was out there saying, hey, we need to have private accounts, because all it is, I will use. But he's saying, hey, there's only one guy. That's it, just one. Nobody else. All that other stuff, just conspiracy theory. And I love that he will stand there in front of these senior citizens and lie to them when he's a guy who he himself has pushed for privatization.
Well, if you remember 2005, I remember the battle well. Rick Santorum was all over this state and didn't do well at all. I mean, he really took a resounding thrashing on that issue. I mean, it was beautiful to see.
Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
History. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant, cause they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican today.
Well, I don't know about that, especially with all of this going on in Washington with Cantor and all the Ron Paul and all the folks saying, well, you know, we need to cut. We need to take cuts away from, you know, we need to get money from other people. Let's pit the poor and the elderly against now disaster victims. That's the way to balance a budget, you know, on the backs of people who are now flooded out and the people whose homes are have been destroyed. That's a good, I guess, a good philosophy, good moral Christian value. Just nuts to me. And I give credit to Chris Christie and I give credit to Bob McDonnell. The Republican governors of Virginia and New Jersey have come out and said, look, have that debate down the road. People need help now. Finally, a Republican couple that get it. Anyway, I've got our good friend on the line, attorney Irwin Aronson. Irwin, what do you think about all this mess?
I'm astounded, Rick, to be perfectly honest with you. But at the same time, I think that since there is a group of people in this country who have decided to play hardball with our lives and demagoguery with our futures, it may be that the government of the United States of America should focus on passing out disaster relief assistance in those areas where people support it and not providing it where in those areas where people don't. I mean, we don't give foreign aid to every country on the planet. We only give it to countries that are supportive of us, so maybe we need to give U.S. aid in the same fashion. And where political structures in existing states have announced that it's their political advantage to criticize the structure of the federal government of the United States, maybe we should treat them as they ask to be treated.
Now, you know, I was looking at something yesterday, and they were talking about that Irene is the now the 10th billion-dollar disaster of this year. And it went back talking about the floods and the tornadoes and all the stuff that ripped through the southern states and the Midwest. And I look at the states that they're talking about, mostly Republican states. the vast majority of them with very radical legislatures and very radical views about things like this. And I go, well, maybe we should just stop helping those people. And maybe they'll wake up. But I can't do that. That's not who I am.
Well, that's the sad thing. It's not who any of us are who are true Americans, the true patriots in this country. But at some point, there needs to be a price that the Rick Perrys of the world and the governors of so many states that have openly, notoriously, quite publicly castigated the idea of the United States of America and have suggested, along with their congressional handmaidens in the nature of the Eric Cantors and Mitch McConnells of the world, that, you know, we don't any longer, as a government of the United States, tax people so that we can provide these services. Instead, we borrow to the hilt, and then when the debt comes due, we tell the poor people and the unemployed and the sick and the indigent that they need to pay the bill by not getting the services that are necessary, or that they should make a choice between medicine and milk, or that they should make a choice between Medicare and funding education for their children.
You know, I look at this whole thing, and someone like Ron Paul, who I guess I have to credit on one level, at least he's consistent.
Yeah.
And look, you know, they feel emboldened. They feel like they can say all those things that they've been whispering to each other in their think tanks and their little secret societies. But here's the thing, you know, this now is an opportunity for the American voter to look at the people in very, very stark comparisons.
Well, it's certainly an opportunity for the American voter to look at people in stark comparisons, but unfortunately, government doesn't really work only and exclusively in the context of broad-based policy decisions that are implemented over time. My wife is fond of saying the following: people plan and God laughs. No matter how much planning we do, we don't have any control over the Hurricane Irenes that befall us from time to time, from season to season, from event to event, from community to community. So it is just wonderful for the demagogues like Eric Cantor to announce to the world that we've drawn a line in the sand and we're not going to tax anybody anymore, and that we're not going to spend on this without cutting from that. But that doesn't account for the disaster that happens. And at some point, we need to recognize there's a reason for us to be a nation as opposed to an anarchy. And the reason for us to be a nation and the reason for us to have a government is for us to be able to do for one another what we can't do for ourselves individually. And responding to a disaster is one of those things. In Philadelphia, in the greater Philadelphia area this past weekend, as hundreds of thousands of people were sleeping in their bathrooms because that was the only place that didn't have a window, and they were hearing on their portable radios and seeing on their cell phones messages about tornadoes coming and 8 consecutive hours of rain that brought 6 or 7 inches of rain in a very, very brief period of time, and flooding. We know that we need to mobilize a society to deal with those things. And we know that the need to mobilize the society is going to come again and again. Somehow we mobilized when it came to fighting a war. Eric Cantor voted for every single bill that has invested and spent and expended $990 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars, fighting a war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Yet we only spend $5.1 billion a year to chase down cancer. Well, guess what? Cancer kills 660,000 Americans every year. And that's an ongoing disaster that we need to deal with. We need to invest in the research to beat cancer before it continues to beat us. And we need to be able to respond to the hurricanes and the fires and the droughts. Texas right now, Rick Perry's home state, is going through the drought of the century from everything I've read, and the people there are going to need help.
Rick Perry's answer is look someplace else.
Or Ron Paul's, you're on your own.
Yeah, well, you know, Ron Paul is that he is consistent, and I think you were quite right to give him credit for his consistency, and he's been consistent over decades, but he's been consistently wrong.
Absolutely.
That's the problem. Where do we go? There are those like the Ron Pauls who are at least consistent and ideologically pure, and there are the others like the Rick Perrys and the Michelle Bachmans and the Eric Cantors and the John Boehners and the Mitch McConnells who are politically opportunistic, but all of them share a thread. It's a thread about which we have spoken in the past. They view today, at least, the Constitution of the United States as nothing more and nothing greater than a treaty among several independent bodies called the several states that are like a pact, if you will, to allow free trade among the states, sort of like the NAFTA among the states, and that unite us only in raising an army and promoting national defense, and in every other respect, the states are all on their own, and the people within those states are on their own, and they point to the 10th Amendment to the Constitution as the justification for this silliness. But at the same time, while they're trying to starve the government of the United States by saying we will not add taxes, saying it even in the face of billionaires like Warren Buffett saying that he's undertaxed, what we have is a series of choices that are foisted upon us, choices that tell us, among other things, that when there is a natural disaster like Hurricane Irene, we're on our own.
And that's a scary proposition. Let me ask you a different line of questioning because the right's losing their mind on this as well. There have been a couple of NLRB things that I wanted to ask you about real quick. This posting that has to happen, as I'm looking at it, I don't see the problem with posting a very small notice saying, hey, you've got the right to organize. I don't see a problem with that.
Well, problem with it? The only people that have a problem with it are people who want to break the law. We need to remember that this has been the law of the United States of America universally since 1935 and in the transportation industry, in railroad and airline, since 1922. And all of a sudden there's a hue and cry that there's something wrong with notifying people that they have a right to organize, to bargain collectively, to choose or refuse to choose a union, and to not have anybody interfere with those rights. The suggestion that this is somehow a radical shift is itself a radical idea. It's a radical idea to say to you and me and to everybody in this country that we have laws and you people are not entitled to notice of your rights under them. How offensive is that? Particularly in an era where people and conservatives specifically are suggesting that the right to know and open government are to be the hallmarks of our democracy. Why everybody in the business community is getting away with having their knickers in a twist over the notion of people knowing their rights is so beyond the American experience that I am, even as verbose as I am, without words to describe an appropriate reaction other than the people who are announcing that this is wrong are themselves lawbreakers and they should be put in jail. They should be incarcerated. They should be prosecuted. They should be exposed for what they are. And what they are advocates of violence. They're advocates of anarchy because when you advocate not letting people know what the law provides, you're advocating that there's something wrong with our legal system.
I agree. Let me ask you this, the last thing I've got. You know, there's this final case that came out before Wilma Liebman left as chairwoman of the NLRB that the right has just got their panties all in a twist about. And it's this Kindred healthcare decision that I guess basically said that you can have smaller bargaining units of trade people. One of the examples they used, that certified nurses assistants could organize of themselves without, you know, throwing everybody else, the janitor and the parking attendant, into that. They're saying that, from what I'm reading, that this is just going back to how the law used to be before the Bush era.
Well, this is not just going back to how the law used to be. This is what the fundamental intent of the law was. In 1935, if one takes the time to do those crazy things that I do from time to time and read the congressional debate over the statutes that are adopted, we'll see that when dealing with the concept of what became the National Labor Relations Act, which really is also known as the Wagner Act, the Congress debated the idea of a group of workers expressing themselves when they have an articulable community of interest. Now, what better community of interest could there be than a group of, for example, registered nurses or nurse assistants all working for the same employer in the same hospital or the same non-acute care facility like a nursing home, saying we who work at the same job are expected to perform the same duties, who ought to be getting basically right around the same pay and have the same kinds of hours, should be allowed to have a unit of workers that is represented locally on the scene. I mean, I keep on hearing about all things are to be local. I keep hearing that the 10th Amendment reserves things to the states and to the people. And here the people who are the advocates of those very notions are the ones who are, as you say, having their pantyhose in a twist over the idea that people locally with a community of interest as contemplated by the Congress of the United States in adopting the National Labor Relations Act, as contemplated by the Supreme Court of the United States in repeatedly declaring the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act, should somehow be nonetheless upset over the idea that small groups of people who have a community of interest should be allowed to have their own organizations that they control or be allowed to refuse to have such an organization if that's what they choose.
Yeah, you know, I've been listening to people go back and forth, and the one person I was talking to recently said, look, you know, this is an opportunity to have what you conservatives always say, multiple unions in the same shop.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the guy over at the Tinky Tank over here in Harrisburg loves to talk about. Oh, I'm not against unions. We should have multiple unions in the same shop. And I say, I agree, one for each craft.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is indeed where, the modern American labor movement started. The old American Federation of Labor, prior to the merger of the AFL and the CIO in 1955 and prior to the creation of the CIO in 1935, was a series of craft unions. And so that's why we have an electricians union, the IBEW, and a plumbers and pipe fitters union, the United Association of Journeymen and Apprentices of the Plumbing and Pipe Fitting Industry. That's why we have bricklayers and allied crafts. That's why we have painters and paper hangers and glazers. That's why we have carpenters and roofers and elevator constructors. That's why we have all of our trades and crafts. And quite simply, if you go to any construction site, there are multiple unions representing multiple crafts working side by side and simultaneously. I keep hearing small is beautiful. I keep hearing local is best. I keep hearing all of these concepts from the conservatives, except when it doesn't amount to their idea, I guess.
Yeah, well, it works when it fits.
Yeah. Well, you know, the intrigue about this is that the people who are objecting to the board's recent decision that you asked about, plus the other two that came out earlier this week that reverse the aberration of Dana Corporation, the Dana Corporation case, having to do with how and when unions are allowed to interact with their members or their potential members. The people who are suggesting that there's something wrong with this are people who advocated a radical change, a radical deviation from 70-odd years of legal development and are suggesting that the labor board under Chairwoman Liebman, somehow did something wrong when all that labor board has done is attempt to require consistency and fealty, loyalty, if you will, to the law as the Congress wrote it, not the law that the Bushites decided it ought to be. And that's what that aberration was, that these three cases in the last couple of days that were announced, they actually were decided 10 days ago, but they were announced in the last 24 to 48 hours. That's all these cases do is restore the status quo. And if ever a group was for the restoration of the status quo, it's been the teabaggers and the conservatives who tell us that the status quo is what they want to protect.
Amazing stuff.
Maybe I should have been a conservative, buddy.
You should, probably should have been, because you make their arguments better than they do with an awful lot more sense. That's why we love having you on the program and look forward each and every week to talking to you.
Well, I'm sorry I was a little late this week, but better late than never, and I'm glad to talk to you, and thanks so much. Be well, be safe, be careful, and we'll talk to you again next week.
All righty. Thank you so much, Irvin. We're going to take a quick break right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, it's official. Now, this would have been a good place, Brett, for you to play I Surrender. This would have been the perfect place for that, to move us right into the whole the segment on, again, the Democrats have shown that steely spine, that fortitude, that stick-to-itiveness, that my way or the highway backbone that I'm talking about the wrong people. I guess the president caved. He will be doing the speech during Monday Night Football, or Thursday night, because they moved the speech. very nice. Well, the speech now will be on September 8th, so we have to wait an extra day to find out what the jobs plan is going to be, and maybe they'll leak a little bit of it beforehand. Again, I'm hoping for chunky, I'm hoping for big, I'm hoping for, well, who am I kidding? That's not going to happen. I'm hoping for something, just something. Much like this Illinois man who was out in his garden one day, you know, digging a little, doing a little dirt, moving around, and you know, planting some seeds, came across a duffel bag containing about $150,000 in it. So he calls the police because, you know, why else would you, know, you found $150,000 in your garden? First thing I would think is, you know, call the cops. He calls because, hey, And the guy, you know, much like I would think, he said, you know, with my luck, it would be part of a bank robbery, and they would come and blame me. And I think I agree with the mentality. So he turns it in. To this point, they have no idea where the $150,000 came from out of this man's garden. Maybe it was just growing there. I don't know. Maybe it just grew there. He put a whole new meaning to growing the cabbage, I guess. But good for him. I hope nobody claims it. And I hope for his sake that they give it back to him.
And he gets to keep it?
That would be nice.
Absolutely.
Never going to happen. but it would be nice. So anyway, you know, he found $150,000, turned it in. Honesty. Our friends on the radical right wanting to cut Social Security. Not so much honesty. Grassley saying only one person. One person, Jake. Just one. Yet the Center for American Progress found 118 who want to do it and destroy it. And I look at all of this disaster stuff that's gone on, and there's a new, to me, there's a new phrase now, disaster austerity. You know, we got disaster capitalism. Now we've got disaster austerity. So basically you got some Guido going, do you want some help? You want some help? What's in it for me? What do you got for me? I mean, it's like sending the Coast Guard out to someone who's drowning and then sitting there waiting for their authorization code from their credit card before you throw them a line. I mean, that's kind of what this is about for me. This is kind of this new thing, this disaster austerity. Before we're going to help you, we got to know that there's money available, because heaven forbid, that we have to pay for something. And I look at Bernie Sanders, who I just think is a great guy. He's quoted as saying, to say that the only way you can come up with funding to rebuild devastated communities is by cutting other desperately needed programs is totally absurd. He said, historically in this country, we have understood that when communities and states experience disasters, we as a nation come together to address those issues. And he's right. This is what being a nation is all about. This is what being Americans is all about. We might, if we're going to go down this path, we should just clip the American thing. I'm a Pennsylvanian now. And when I lived in Ohio, I was an Ohioan. Or, you know, and maybe that's how we have to start addressing ourselves. If we're going to be 50 individual states, if we're going to be 50 individual little countries with our own little thing, let's just go that route. Let's admit it, go forward. Cantor's spokesperson, a guy named Brad Dayspring, he said, clearly, when disasters and emergencies happen, people expect their government to treat them as national priorities. People also expect the government to spend their dollar wisely and to make efforts to prioritize and save when possible. I mean, this is the same BS argument that they make about healthcare. You know, we should be more selective. Shop around. So when I have a heart attack, I should have the local hospitals on speed dial checking the specials. What? Broken leg? Broken limbs are on sale this week? I think I'll wait. And, of course, die. And here's what the compassionate conservatism out of Ron Paul came out. He was on fake news on Fox. He said the bleeding heart will say, well, we have to take care of them. And I asked, don't we? Don't we have to help them at some point? And I would say, hey, Whitey, remember after Hurricane Katrina, the conservatives, they tried to push a little bit, and but they ended up giving in. And everyone thought it was because the people down there were black. Turns out, Whitey, they don't care about you either. It's about protecting the green class. It's not about black. It's not about white. It's about green class. So I cannot wait for our geniuses to come back to Washington and let the gridlock begin. Budget, baby, budget. Because we're going to hear about this. This. If we're bickering over a date, what's it going to be like in the next couple of weeks? I don't know. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. You know it's gonna take you by. You know it's gonna take you by.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. From Maine to California tomorrow, nurses are converging on 60 congressional offices in 21 states to call for a tax on Wall Street to pay for the economic healing of our nation. Union RNs will sponsor soup kitchens and food pantries as they speak out on the need for jobs, health care, education, and housing. National Nurses United says the message is that Americans are hurting and they need jobs, a secure retirement, and no more austerity cuts. Nurses are asking members of Congress to sign a pledge to support a Wall Street transaction tax that will raise sufficient revenue to make Wall Street pay for the devastation that it's caused on Main Street. National Nurses United says a Wall Street tax on the very speculative financial activities that caused the 2008 financial meltdown could raise hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for the programs desperately needed to reduce the pain and suffering working families are still feeling. As the United Auto Workers Union tries to reach a new contract with the Detroit 3 automakers, workers at Ford are voting on a strike authorization in case one is needed. Ford's 41,000 UAW workers are the only Detroit auto workers who can still strike, if necessary. Ford workers want to raise the restoration of their cost of living allowances and higher starting wages for the entry-level workers who earn just half of what veteran UAW members make. The Detroit 3 auto contracts expire September 14th. UAW President Bob King says concessions and givebacks by the union to help save the U.S. auto industry has cost auto workers between $7,000 and $30,000 each over the life of the contract. The Communications Workers of America aren't waiting until Congress reconvenes to start the battle over funding for the Federal Aviation Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
Republicans have been unwilling to permanently reauthorize funding for FAA programs due to opposition to a new mediation rule they fear would make it easier for airline employees to form unions. The last time the GOP stonewalled funding, it resulted in a shutdown of portions of the FAA, costing the government nearly $400 million. It saw more than 75,000 employees, both FAA employees and construction workers, furloughed without pay. If the Republicans return to Congress with the desire to play games with jobs, it could result in a shutdown as soon as September 16th. The CWA has launched mailers and robocalls, encouraging taxpayers to pressure their representatives to pass a clean FAA reauthorization bill. One of the primary targets of the CWA is House Transportation Committee Chairman John Mica of Florida. The union has launched a website called Mica Watch, counting down to the next potential shutdown.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com if you missed any portion of the program. TherickSmithShow.com is where you go. You can download our podcast, and if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app. Take your program on the go. Interesting story from Waukesha, Wisconsin, and you know what? That's twice in one show I have used the fair city of Waukesha, Wisconsin. Evidently, a woman ordered a tree online, lemon tree. Her and her daughter nurtured the, or her and her niece, I think it was, nurtured their special tree. And, you know, it started to begin to yield lemons. And, you know, the tree seemed to be healthy. The problem, the company that they bought it from, was violating a number of quarantine laws down in Florida. So the government said, the USDA said, hey, look, you've got to give us this tree. This company sent out about 1,000 of these citrus plants across the across the country, and what they're saying is that of these people, a lot of them are suffering from seizures, which is kind of weird, but because they want these plants back. So what the right is saying, and I kind of love the argument that This is regulation run amok. This is them, the government, you know, that government that we hate. This is them overextending their bounds. And, you know, the article read, you know, she was upset because they took her lemon tree. And I said, you know, can you not have these kind of laws to make sure that if this thing has a disease, because it had numerous, evidently the ones that they were quarantined had numerous diseases that could spread and, if not localized, could cause major problem in other areas. So it's the whole reason that when you go on the plane to another country, they don't let you bring produce back with you because they carry certain bugs and certain diseases. And people get upset about that, but you know, here's the thing. You know, they took this tree back, and they sent her another one, but she's still upset because, well, we spent 3 years on this tree, but it could kill everything in your yard. But again, that's too far. Government we don't need. But on the other hand, we've got Republicans who are complaining that what's going on in Wisconsin is there are these signs popping up that folks want to recall Walker. And the folks are saying, well, this is illegal. We have sign laws. We have political sign laws. And the Republicans are, you know, pretty ticked off about this. And the ACLU, who, again, twice in one day, I'm talking about the ACLU, one thing you kind of wonder about this one, they're saying, look, good luck in enforcing these laws. It's freedom of speech. These people are putting these signs out in their yard. You know, it is what it is. But you've got these townships who, you know, Republicans are trying to push them to get these signs out of the yards.
Well, you can say what you want about the ACLU, but they basically fight for constitutional rights. And I might add some quite controversial issues they've tackled over the years. You have to admire them for that, whether you like them or not, whether you support them or not.
I like them about 60% of the time.
And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. And when I talked to the guy who was like the director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, he said, that's about what you should. You know, he said, I only like us about 60% of the time. If I remember the interview right, he said, look, you know, I don't like some of the people, because, you know, the ACLU actually defended Rush Limbaugh with the whole drug shopping thing.
Well, they would be the ones to defend that Baptist church from Missouri and say, look, these people might be, they wouldn't say it.
You mean Kansas?
Was it Kansas? Okay. You might think they're scumbags, and I do. I certainly do, and I'm sure you do. But at the end of the day, they have the constitutional right to be assholes. So,
how long have you been doing this show?
A couple years.
And you don't know that you can't use that word on air?
Keep on moving.
Okay. Anyway. And I agree. They're idiots. And we need to be done with that. So today I was sitting around, and I was thinking about, I'm in the process of writing an op-ed for Labor Day. So I've been thinking about, you know, this whole holiday, what direction should we be going? Should we be celebrating the holiday in the normal way of barbecues and beer fests? Should we be doing something in the way of parades where, like in Wisconsin, they said no Republicans? And then, of course, the Republicans came out and said, well, if you won't let us come in, we're not going to let the towns pay for it. So then they had to retract it, whole nine yards. Should we do something with some activism? Should we be out marching in the streets instead of parades in the streets? And I started thinking back to my grandfather, who I, you know, for years had a very love-hate relationship with. Look, you know, I was in my teen years struggling with, you know, with the death of my mother and the whole nine yards that went with that, and struggling with, you know, him not liking me. But on a lot of things, he was spot on. And I've been thinking back to that generation. I've been thinking about an awful lot and the things that they did in returning from World War II. And in the years leading up, all of the fight that went on, not just in the battlefields, but also in the workplaces. And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, what they accomplished. And I'm looking at this Labor Day holiday, and I'm hoping at some point that we can return to that kind of community, that kind of neighborly kind of commitment to each other. Because what's happened is the wealth class has done a very nice job of of pitting us against each other and not allowing us to be with each other. And this Labor Day holiday should mean something, especially this one, because this is the one, this is the first one post all of the attacks. I think this is a special one. Don't you?
I think all anniversaries of 9/11 should be special. Should this be ultra special?
Mm. You mean Labor Day?
Oh, you're talking Labor Day. I'm sorry. Okay. Of course. Labor Day should be special.
So I'm thinking about this, and I went back and I started thinking about all of the organizing that went on, the fact that you had this great boom of organizing. Over a third of the workforce unionized, another third at least making comparable wages, the whole structure going upward. And this ability, and I've been thinking about my grandparents, who, when my grandfather came back from World War II, they were married for the old-fashioned reason, had to. And they really had nowhere to go, so they were staying with friends, they were staying with relatives, staying in their car. And I think about that time and the struggle that must have gone on then. And I look at the trajectory of their life. And how they were able to achieve the American dream by moving into a solidly middle-class neighborhood. Because the jobs that they held paid solidly middle-class wages with health care benefits. So they were insulated from when, you know, the kids needed braces, or insulated from when the kids needed tonsils out, or when they broke arms, or, you know, all of the things that happened to kids along the maturation process. They were insulated from that. Because they had health insurance. They were insulated from poverty and old age because they had pensions, they had Social Security. And you stop and you think about all of this stuff that they fought for and they worked diligently for and they invested in so that their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren could have a similar thing and could have a brighter opportunity. And I remember my grandfather telling me, you know, they grew up in a house with a dirt floor, no indoor plumbing, and they would have to run down to the railroad tracks to quote unquote find coal, which meant they hopped on the coal cars and threw it off. And I think the statute of limitations is up on that, considering he's been dead for several years. I think it's okay to now talk about that. But you look at that and you look at the path of their life and what they fought for and what they wanted for their children and their grandchildren. And I look at the attacks that are going on right now, and I wonder if I could talk with him today, if I could ask him what he thought, what that generation thinks about what's going on today. And I know, Jake, you like to call them the greatest generation, and in a lot of ways they were. They did fight the wars, not only on the battlefield, but also in the workplace. And they did invest in the country's future, and they did put off self-gratification for today so that there could be a better tomorrow, and they did those things selflessly. They did those things out of a sense of community, out of a sense of country, out of a sense of I hate to use the word camaraderie, because you know, you're going to get someone who goes, all right, socialists, say we know, but they did these things so that we could have what we have today. And I think about all of the things that we're fortunate about, you know, the labor protections, the safety laws, the minimum wage, all of those things, weekends, Social Security, Medicare, the list goes on, that haven't always been. There's no benevolent force out there that said, here, you can have these things. There's no benevolent force that says, oh, we like you so much, we're going to give you all this stuff. It's not there. They had to fight for it, and they did. And what frustrates me is it appears to me that we're just giving it all back for nothing in return. That, to me, is what's frustrating. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Have you found it necessary to declare on national television that, quote, I am a serious person? You're probably not. Meet Michelle Bachmann. She's currently running for president, but suffering a few credibility problems. One is that she keeps creating her own fanciful version of history. For example, she recently bewildered Iowa voters by asserting that the Founding Fathers had magnanimously included every American in the nation's new government. Quote, it didn't matter the color of people's skin, she marveled. It didn't matter whether they were of a higher class or a lower class. It made no difference. Seriously? Indeed, Bachmann plowed straight ahead into a fantasy about the Founders' glorious work to free the slaves. She insisted that these wealthy, white, slave-owning men, quote, worked tirelessly until slavery was no more in the United States. Seriously. No surprise, then, that the Congresswoman also invents her own personal history. While she unsparingly attacks Washington's spending addiction, she apparently doesn't own a mirror. It turns out that her husband's counseling clinic has received thousands of dollars in state and federal grants. Oh, she dodges, those tax dollars didn't come to us. Seriously? Yes, she explains, the money went to train our clinic's employees, as though that's not a subsidy for their business. Then there is the $260,000 in subsidies for her family's farm. Oh, she dissembled, that went to my father-in-law, adding that I have never gotten a penny from the farm. Seriously? But wait, she's listed as a partner in the farm, and her financial disclosure forms report that, in fact, she has received $105,000 in income from it. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bachmann says she wants to take government back. And in all seriousness, it looks like she's already clawing back her piece of it.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
And it was an inside job, and now he has pled guilty, John Purcell, 8 of the 82 counts. And I gotta wonder, what kind of a sweetheart deal did he get when you only had to plead to 8 of the 82 counts of corruption and theft and the whole corruption stew that he was being charged with? I'm just trying to figure this out. How do you get to only plead to 8 of them, of the 82, and how much time is he going to do?
Did you catch your comments from some of the people in his caucus?
No.
Most of them were saying, you know, John was a master. He was a master at inside politics and coming up with deals. Apparently, he's still got it. Right. I mean, think about that. He only has to plead to a fraction of what he was accused of? That's a pretty good deal.
We've yet to see what the 8 are, true, though, and how long of a sentence he's up for. He is going to lose his $85,000 a year pension. That's gone. And again, you know, for your freedom, you'll give up a little bit of money because I'm sure he's loaded. But he's likely to do a little time, and he's not a young guy. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. You know, he gave the whole spiel. Oh, I'm sorry. I regret my actions. You have the right to expect better from me.
I thought that was pretty generic.
Sorry.
I let you down.
Yeah. You know, at the
pretty
end of
generic.
It, at the end of it, you go, no, you're not. You're sorry you got caught. But here's the thing. And I look at what he did, and I look at what Vion did, and that's how things were done at the time. And they're still probably being done. You talk to anybody who's worked on these campaigns, you know the offices do some work. They try and they separate it. They try to, but That's just how this game has always been played. It's just that Corbett wanted to make a name for himself, and he did. He made a very nice name for himself. And these people were out of control. I mean, so you had a perfect storm, I think. You had an ambitious attorney general, and you had people who were completely drunken with power, and completely out of control, and completely off the path.
I mean, if you read the prior articles in the paper, I mean, he actually went after people in his caucus. I mean, he used taxpayer money to do that. They went out and bought sophisticated software, and he didn't like you, or he didn't like the way you voted. He got somebody to vote against you, and then, oh, this is really nice, he conducted a dirty campaign against you.
Well, of course.
All at my expense and your expense.
Well, that's the game. And look, both sides did it. But he was just a little bit better at it from the people that I've talked to. And again, you know, I hope he gets at least as much as Vian got.
And he might.
Well, and he should. I mean, I would think that there's some kind of shenanigans going on if he doesn't get at least the 6-14 that Vian got. Just a thought. Also, other criminal charges, some 16 new charges of perjury and tampering with evidence, according to the, I think this was the Post-Gazette, that the Ori sisters are now going to be facing. And I look at this, and again, it's another one of those, these we used our office, and this, to me, just dumb. If they have evidence and she did what they claim she did, scanning documents after the fact into a computer and basically making a paper trail to cover her behind, she deserves to go away for a very long time.
She's a former prosecutor.
I don't care what she is. She deserves to go to jail.
If anyone should know better, and they said, according to eyewitnesses, and this comes from people involved in the case, it was so amateurish you could actually see the telltale copy. You know, sometimes a copier doesn't do it quite right. She's trying to cover her keister by saying, well, these memos were written long before, in fact, they were, and they were made up. That's my opinion. I think she's going to be convicted, and she could face some prison time.
And good. And her prison sentence, I would be happy to make sure that the taxpayer pay for.
Well, but she's also involved her sister, Jean Ori Melvin, who's a Supreme Court justice.
Again, another person who should know better.
The web of corruption, it's getting very
interesting. In fact, you can put them in the same cell. They can sit right next to each other. Sad, sad stuff, man.
Well, here's a question. Mr. Gustafsson, who's known as one of the best defense lawyers, certainly in the state, maybe in the country.
You got to wonder if he knew.
Did he violate the law if he was part of this conspiracy? I mean, he's part of the defense team coming up with this defense. Could he be prosecuted? Is that possible?
Well, if he knowingly put information into the trial, if he knowingly brought that out, yeah, absolutely. Now, again, you're going to have to prove what did he know, when did he know it, and go from there. But, yeah, absolutely. In fact, you can put the three of them in a cell together.
Wow, that would be big, big, big news. This man is a very powerful, politically connected lawyer.
Now, we'll see. We shall see. But again, it comes down to the dollars and cents. It comes down to the money. It comes down to, this is a dirty game. And the more we allow behind-the-scene deals, backroom deals, the more this money that comes into the system that we're not tracking, that we don't know who it comes from, the worse this system gets. And I just saw a report that in the first half of this year, both of the parties, both the Democrat and the Republicans, they have combined taken in some $242 million to use in campaigns. And I'm going, $242 million? It sounds like an awful lot of money, and it is, but when you're talking about the kind of things that these folks decide on, that's kind of chump change. And you know, I go back to the idea that we need to have some publicly financed elections so that we're not beholden to the big special interests. We're not beholden to the wealth class for meager donations. Now, I've been spending a lot of time, you know, kind of reading through how these big billionaires are spending money in very small amounts, setting up little think tanks in these colleges and funding little special institutes, you know, like the Hoover Institute or the Mercatus or any of those that are these radical right wing offshoots who push this bizarre ideology at the behest of the billionaire class, and it's just for a very little bit of money. I mean, I'm really amazed at how little it takes. You know, like in I think it was Minnesota, where the local Republican Party was auctioning off time with your representative, where you would, you know, you could go, like on eBay, you could go and, you know, bid on, you know, 15 minutes with this guy to make your pitch. And I think it was like $250. You'd get 15 minutes of his time to make your pitch and pull him around. That, to me, is pretty cheap. Pretty cheap. And I remember, you know, our good friend Phil Hare, who was a congressman from Illinois, and I hope he runs again, because the guy that that beat him was, well, has been horrible. But he said, look, he goes, you know, when I have to go and I have to ask for this money, and I have to, I don't have a choice. I can't magically fund elections, you know, because they're always out to get me. There's always NRA money. There's always national manufacturers money. There's always big business money trying to take this seat because it's an even district. And he said, look, you know, I've got to ask for money. And invariably, when I ask, it's always, well, you know, but first let me tell you my story. And then I've got to sit there and I've got to listen. And look, that money isn't buying my vote. And I don't say it's buying the Republicans' vote. But it gives you access. It gives you their ear. And they sit and have to listen to you and respond. And you know what? To be honest, you know, some of these lobbyists are pretty slick. They could sell a ketchup popsicle to a woman, you know, walking in the desert, wearing white gloves and a wedding dress. And they're talking to people who basically won a popularity contest. They're not the brightest bulbs in the box. These are people who just, you know, hey, vote for me, look at me, you know. They're not the experts. So they're easily, you know, I think any one of us could be easily swayed one way or the other based on, hey, you know, this is my argument. Listen to me. Okay, here's $2,000. And that's the kind of money it takes, Jake, and it's not a lot of money. Very little bit.
Well, you talk to any congressman, I've heard my congressman complain about that. The truth is, once the election's over, that next day he's got to start because they run every 2 years. And, as you said, if you happen to be a Democrat in a either swing district or a district where your opponents can raise a lot of money, you're not left any choice. You're not left any. Here's the problem. Here's the problem with the system in general, and if you're talking about campaign finance reform, the very people who benefit are going to have to say we want to change the system. It's like trying to tell an alcoholic that, hey, you know, we're going to wean you off your beer or your whiskey. That's not an easy task. And let's face it, some of these politicians are drunk with the idea of big campaign war chests. They like that. They like to win. They like the power. They like all the prestige that goes with it. And it's going to be hard to pass that in Congress right now. I hope that changes. But you're right. In the end, if we're going to change the system, we're going to have to do something about this corroding influence of money. And it's even worse now, thanks to the Supreme Court. The system is just swamped with money now.
I don't know. Sometimes you got to wonder. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio and News Service. Stick around.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Sitting at the kitchen table with Tom and his laptop.
My name's Tom, and I'm here today to learn how to save money on my prescriptions with Capital Blue Cross.
Capital's VP of Pharmacy Services, Meenock, is here. She's showing Tom how to use the Capital website to learn his prescription price before he heads to the pharmacy today.
You would want to know what is the cost of that medication to basically stretch your health care dollar, because that's your dollar.
The point is, members have options to save time and money. And if Tom wants to log on at 1 a.m. to renew a prescription, that's fine, too.
Having that flexibility to be able to order prescriptions at any time of the day or night is fantastic.
And the mail order feature is really like a self-service feature. We love that.
Meenock doesn't usually make house calls, but today she's happy to help.
This is one of the ways we care more, so we do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
What is going on in Washington? I mean, this thing between Obama and Boehner, and really, I guess it shows how childish Boehner is, in my opinion. Your thoughts?
Well, yes, although I have to say, I'm not sure that either side is much over the age of 12. There's a little bit of fault on both sides. From what I can gather, I'm not sure that the White House conducted due diligence in clearing the date of this joint session of Congress with the Speaker's office before they announced it. Having said that, I think that the Speaker's office was a little gleeful in firing back a public letter saying, you can't come. Sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, what is this? You know, Bridezilla? I mean, I'm just not getting it. When in history has a president said, I want to come and talk to you, and they said, no, I think you need to hold that up. You didn't send me a save the date note, so we didn't save it for you.
Yeah, we need 3 hours to do a security sweep, and we just came back that night, and we're washing our hair, and it's not going to work for us.
Just not good. In fact, we'd like you to do it tomorrow night, right in the middle of football, so you can tick everybody off.
Right, doing them in the football, and because it has nothing to do with our presidential debate.
Well, there's another one of those positions there. But then again, I guess you could look at it as maybe the president saw that as well.
Well, I think that, you know, I really think that anybody who thinks that the president did not see this is not looking at the presidential optics as well. I think both sides, I have to say, carry some blame on this one, and I think it was a foolish move all around. It didn't need to happen like this. I think if this had been done sort of the old-fashioned way, with protocol and with aides talking behind the scenes first, didn't need to work out like this. Instead, what you've got now is you've got White House aides talking to Boehner's aides now at 8:30 at night that's not the way it should be. It shouldn't be the aides talking to everybody when the entire country is now saying, okay, so they're not even back from the summer recess and already they don't get on. How does this bode for trying to get things worked out for the super committee before November the 23rd?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I saw this and I just kind of sat back in my chair and I said, you know what, we're screwed. I mean, just completely screwed. They can't even agree on the president coming and giving a speech. What's going to happen with this super committee who evidently Pat Toomey told the town hall he had way up in Potter County with the trees and all 50 people who live there who showed up that he doesn't know when the secret meetings are. And even if he did, he couldn't tell because they're secret.
Yeah.
Kind of scary. Kind of scary stuff.
It doesn't bode well. Having said that, I have to say that both sides of the super committee did agree to, you know, one of the chief staffers. So that's encouraging.
There's a start. Yeah. Well, that's something. But I looked at this and I said, man, I'm you know, November can't come quick enough. And speaking of November, the Republican Mitt Romney, I guess, the Tea Party kind of turning it. He has done everything he can do to court them, and I hear they're going to protest him?
Yes, it's Freedom Works, which is Dick Armey's group, and they've been helping to organize the Tea Party Express's Reclaiming America bus tour. And he is speaking to Tea Party Express supporters on Sunday in New Hampshire, and Freedom Works is no involved with the tour. Because it allowed Romney and Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah, to speak, according to Freedom Works president. They're saying that Mitt Romney and Orrin Hatch have supported and expanded the role of government through government-run health care, Wall Street bailouts, and spending hikes.
So they invited him to speak?
Well, they were involved with it. But they're saying that they've decided to end their participation in the Reclaiming America tour. But rather than just ending it, they're now going to protest it actively.
Oh, good.
And he's really been struggling to connect with Tea Party supporters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because we've been talking about this for some time. I mean, he's doing everything that he can possibly do to go to the extreme right. Because in the primary, you're going to have to. And then after the primary, he'll be able to move back towards the center and try and absorb some of the independents. But in the primary, he's got to go hard right.
And, yes, indeed.
And speaking of the telephone that's ringing in the background, it appears AT&T, their merger shot down.
Well, not yet, but there's an attempt to shoot it down by the Justice Department. They filed a lawsuit today to block the $30 billion merger between AT&T and T-Mobile on antitrust grounds. What the Justice Department is saying is that this deal, which is between the second and the fourth largest wireless phone carriers, they're saying it would lessen competition a lot, it will result in higher prices, and it's going to give consumers less products that are, you know, innovative and exciting and new.
Yep.
So this is setting up like the granddaddy of antitrust battles.
Let me ask you this, because you're from across the pond, I understand, correct?
Yes.
In your neck of the woods, do they have a duopoly, which is this is basically what's going to happen? And do they have competition? Do they have multiple plans? What's it like over there?
They do have multiple plans, and it seems to work. They have laws. I mean, they have antitrust laws. It seems to work. They have anti-competition. If you remember, Rupert Murdoch recently had some difficulties because he wanted to buy an even larger portion of Sky.
Right.
Of Sky Television, and he's been coming in for some difficulty with that because of on competition grounds in the UK.
Because some of the people that I've talked to who live over there, they say, look, we've got much better products, we've got much better choice of plans, they're cheaper, it's just better in their opinion. And I was curious if you had had that same thought as some of the folks that I've talked to.
I haven't lived there for so long that I can't speak with authority.
All right. Well, I just figured I would ask. But you, the people that you've talked to, is this a good thing? Because I don't want to see more mass consolidation. I've seen enough media consolidation. I think we should be using these antitrust laws. And I know it goes against, you know, some of my union support, but, you know, the reality is we just can't have these mass conglomerates continuing to grow. I just don't think it's good for the country.
Consumer advocacy groups are really excited. They're saying that, look, getting rid of T-Mobile is a low-cost option. It's going to raise prices and lower choices and really turn it into a duopoly controlled by AT&T and Verizon. But others on the other side are saying, look, they said that when they were going to do this, they, in fact, would be bringing back at least 5,000 call center jobs from overseas. So, in fact, what you're doing is you're stifling job creation.
Well, that came out first thing this morning, and then the decision came out. So I saw one thing that said it was going to create 96,000 jobs or something like that, and I'm going, that's kind of hard for me to imagine when you're merging companies together and getting rid of people through because of redundancy and that wonderful word that they use, synergy. I love that.
Yes.
Just an excuse to fire people.
Yes.
Well, we'll see how this turns out. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And now to Jake It Up. What do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. Rich Trumka has announced a new jobs plan, and also he's called for a new political voice for workers. The nation's ailing economy needs a prescription powerful enough to heal the jobs crisis, and America's working family needs an independent political voice that's not beholden to parties or politicians, according to AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka. At a Labor Day press conference this afternoon, Trumka unveiled an American Wants to Work Jobs and Economy Initiative that is serious and selects the scale of the crisis we face. The plan includes the following: rebuilding the nation's transportation and energy infrastructure, reviving U.S. manufacturing and ending the exportation of U.S. jobs, putting people to work in local communities, helping states and local governments to prevent layoffs and cuts to public services, extending unemployment insurance benefits and helping homeowners keep their homes, and reforming Wall Street so that it helps Main Street create jobs. Trump also announced the creation of the independent super PAC that will build the political power for Americans' silent majority, the middle class, and the poor who are struggling to get by, unquote. It will be an effort by and for working people, communicating beyond our membership and striving to ensure all who work a strong and clear voice in the political process. And I say it's about time. Amen, Mr. Trumka. A little bit of discouraging news coming out of that AT&T job situation. AT&T has vowed, it's easier for me to say, to return about 5,000 jobs to the United States. But unfortunately, the Department of Justice is going to sue. If AT&T's merger with T-Mobile is approved, AT&T will bring approximately 5,000 wireless jobs home that are now performed offshore back to the United States. The company announced this week AT&T also promised the merger would not result in any job losses for current call center workers at AT&T Mobility or T-Mobile USA. Today's announcement by the Justice Department that it will sue to block the merger is, quote, simply wrong and puts good jobs and workers' rights at the bottom of the government's priorities, according to the Communication Workers of America spokesman. Instead of acting to block this merger, a government should be looking to support companies that create, keep, and return good jobs in the United States. Along with the return of jobs and AT&T's commitment to not shed jobs, CWA says the merger has additional positive gains for workers, consumers, communities, and the industry. It would accelerate the buildup of high-speed wireless broadband to 97% of the nation. AT&T will develop T-Mobile's assets and offer T-Mobile customers the latest in technology. AT&T and T-Mobile utilize compatible technologies, and AT&T has demonstrated its commitment to workers' rights, supporting management neutrality that enables workers to make a free and fair choice about union representation and bargaining rights. So hopefully, I understand where the government's coming from, but at this point in time, considering the amount of jobs and considering the overall situation, I hope that that situation irons itself out,
so
and,
these jobs,
and we can pull these jobs into America.
Are there any guarantees? Is this contractual? Because I had seen an article that said 96,000 jobs they were going to create. And again, I don't know where that came from, but I saw a whole bunch of jobs being created out of this. And can you make a justification for having companies merge together where you add jobs instead of doing away with the redundancy that generally happens when you merge two companies together?
Can I make an argument?
I've asked you the question. Is there if you put two companies together, you got two sets of production people, you got two sets of phone call people, you got two sets of management people. When you merge them together and you merge their operations, do you not generally shed the redundancy? Do you not that the word synergy mean anything?
Yes, yes,
you
I
are
understand
now getting
what you're
rid
saying.
Of people
there
because
are...
it doesn't make any sense on any logical level. That by bringing these and creating this monstrosity, that it's going to work out.
So what you're saying is you believe that possibly the amount of jobs that you would lose through the natural merger, even though you're gaining 5,000, it might be a wash, could even be a net loss.
Well, I mean, right now they're saying to get this pushed through that they're going to bring those 5,000 back. What's to say in a year or two that they don't go back? I mean, do we have any guarantees? And the answer is no.
You probably don't. You probably don't. But let me put it this way.
Don't we generally talk about using antitrust laws?
Yes.
Don't we generally talk about not liking to encourage monopolies?
We do. No. We do, but we're usually talking about curbing the negative effect of corporations just running roughshod over consumers. This is a little bit different angle. I understand where you're coming from.
I'm asking how.
It's a tough question. There's positives on both sides. CWA is coming out for it.
The only positive I see is that they're going to have the opportunity to organize those workers, and for those workers, that's a good thing. I'm 100% in favor of that. All in. I just don't want to see a duopoly. You know, you see what happens in Europe. They have numerous companies who are doing this. They have better plan structures. They have lower prices. They have more competition. This is in Europe. And we're talking about here, again, going back. Didn't we break up AT&T for a reason? Didn't we break up Ma Bell for
Absolutely.
A reason?
Absolutely.
And now it looks like we're going back to this. That's my beef.
Well, my one comment is I do believe that AT&T is without a doubt more union friendly. My other comment is
really?
than mobile, T-Mobile. Oh, absolutely.
Considering that they spend an awful lot of money propping up right wing candidates and spending an awful lot of money,
I'm talking about when I say union friendly, Rick. I'm talking about their operations being unionized. That's what I mean by union friendly. As far as the spending, you could be absolutely right. What's perplexing to me, and I'm not saying the Justice Department is right or wrong, but where are they?
You did say they were wrong. Right at the very beginning, you said the Justice
According to this article, I mean, we can argue the pros and cons, but if I can explain my position.
Well, you did. You said
well,
no,
wait
you're
a
against
minute.
It.
No, wait a minute. I'm perplexed as to why the Justice Department, when they... very much have been absent when it comes to corporate entities violating the antitrust laws. I don't see them. We have talked about it numerous times. Where are they? Where are they? Now, all of a sudden, they're entering this picture. I'm a bit perplexed. They could wind up winning this case, the Justice Department, and in the end, you could be right. It might be better if this doesn't go through. However, I'm still perplexed at the inequities of the Justice Department. How did they pick this case?
Well, these are telecoms. These are direct. There's a you had four companies, now you have three, and two of them will control the vast majority of the market. Now, if what they're saying is true and they're going to do all this investment, which I'm not going to say they're not going to, but it just seems to me from a logical standpoint that when you control that much, you then have the ability to pretty much said anything you want.
Well, you can look at other industries related to TV, radio, communications, and wow, there's a few giants that are just dominating the industry.
And we should have stopped that when we had the chance.
And then you look at the situation with Walmart.
So just because we've done this in the past and we've allowed it to happen in the past, should we continue down that path?
Well, that's the question that they face.
And you said the Justice Department was wrong. I'm simply saying I don't think so.
Well, I'm referring to this article, and from the perspective of the unions involved and the union jobs, they disagree with the Justice Department. Now we shall see.
That's their position.
We shall see.
All right, going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap this up.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Has to be done for the next generation, with the courage to fight for freedom, with the courage to fight for America. That's why I'm announcing today that I'm running for president of the
Today in New York's Times Square, there's a little heat of the moment going on. Zoe West, a 21-year-old young lady, stood nude there on 44th Street and Broadway for about 2.5 hours while an artist, Andy Golub, painted her. The police came, took her away. Turns out they didn't charge her with anything. And why should they? I mean, what's wrong with a naked 21-year-old woman standing on the street corner? It couldn't be any worse than the trash that's on the street in Times Square there. I mean, really, stop and think about it. Have you ever been there? I mean, you know, they cleaned it up a little bit, but still, there's trash in the road there. I'd rather look at that. But here again, they released her because evidently in New York, public nudity is allowed if it's part of a play, a performance, an exhibition, or a show. And they're saying that this was part of that, and they let her go. Good for her. There's nothing wrong with...
So she wasn't being painted. Okay.
No, she was being painted, you know, by the artist, Mr. Golub.
Okay.
Who I'm sure did very nice work. I personally would be distracted, but, you know, okay, good for him. I don't know if you saw the new lineup of Dancing with the Stars.
I missed it.
Got to be honest, I've never seen it. I've never, not even once. I saw a commercial once, but never watched it. Evidently, Nancy Grace is going to take time from wanting to kill that Casey Anthony.
Nancy Grace.
Evidently, Ron Artest, the basketball player, is going to take a little time away from the court. And David Arquette, who I just don't get why you would leave Courtney Cox to do this show for just a minute. I just don't get it. And, of course, Chaz Bono. And you may know the name Chaz Bono as the only child of Sonny and Cher. Little story. And I saw some of the pictures. And Chaz used to be a woman. Chaz had a sex change. Chaz is now a man. And a really, really big fat man. And I'm going, if you're going to go through the process of having everything, you know, kind of changed around and all the plumbing changed, why not change all the plumbing so that you don't look like me? I mean, really, are you going to spend all that money? I'm looking at this woman and going, really? You went through all of that surgery, all that pain, and you didn't do something about the, 5 foot, 300 pound thing? Anyway, this ought to be interesting to see her going through the Dancing with the Stars thing. Will she? I guess it's a he now, so I guess he will lead. So, you know, good for him. Whatever makes you happy, I don't care. I just thought it was interesting that I'm Dancing with the Stars. This will make my children very happy. Evidently, the folks over at King's College London, the researchers there, are studying underwater coral reefs, and they think that they're going to be able to develop a pill that will prevent sunburn. They're claiming that these coral reef formations have the ability to protect themselves from the harsh UV rays in the tropical climates, and that they can just take a pill. Because when we take our kids out, like we go bike riding or go to the park or do anything, you got to slather them up with all of this sunscreen. And I often wonder, what's in that stuff? Will the sunscreen actually cause them cancer down the road, and they fight like cats and dogs to not have to do it? So, boy, a pill might be so much better, don't you think? And with today being the beginning of my son's academic career as a kindergartner, I thought about some good parenting stories, because I like to think that my wife is an excellent parent. I'm at home quite often, but she does a fantastic job. So I thought some good parenting stories, like this woman in Gilbert, Arizona, who evidently the police claim she blew marijuana smoke into her 10-month-old daughter's mouth just to kind of help her stop crying. Her roommate actually took a video of her spanking a 10-month-old because the baby would not stop crying. And I'm going, really? You're going to spank a 10-month-old? Do they understand why you're spanking them or even the words coming out of your mouth? And then she went and several times blew marijuana smoke into their mouth. I'm going, wow, just nuts. They let anybody have children. But a dog, you need a license. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the wonderful show this evening, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, download the Stitcher app and take the program with you. If you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, you want to rip on me a little bit, I'm always happy to see that. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I want to thank Dean Baker for coming on the program again. His book, Free, at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on his name there on the website. Also, our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, always great to talk to him. And, of course, Scott Klingler with the piece on executives and their excessive pay. And I say, you know, go to the website. There's wonderful resources there, especially the articles by Scott Klingler. That, again, stuff we already knew. The CEO class doing very, very well, while everyone else, maybe not so well. So anyway, have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy's coming. Today will escape.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Vance said God.